play a brew or make day two? What if you don't have to choose? My name is Dan Schriever, and this is Faithless Brewing. Each week, we design spicy new decks geared at tournament play. We put our creations to the test in competitive leagues and share our findings on the air. Coming up this week on the Roundup, Modern has a new Tier 1, but the London Mulligan and a possible banning announcement are just around the corner. Plus, a tournament report with Black-Green Rock. Good old Rock. Nothing beats Rock. After that, on the Flashback, testing results with Force of Virtue in Mardu Pyromancer, Esper Skies, and an updated build of Goat Devotion, a deck on the very bleeding edge of modern technology. Finally, on the Brew Session, we go deep on Lotus Field from Core Set 2020, a fixed version of a land that can tap for 3 mana. As we always say, if it's fixed, let's break it. All of that and more is coming up on this edition of Faithless Brewing. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Welcome to episode 10 of Faithless Brewing. I am David Robertson, joined as always by Daniel Schriever. He is Cave Dan on MTGO. Dan, how's it going?
I'm doing great, Dave. Had a good weekend. Played a lot of Magic, watched some Magic too, and got some hilarious screenshots for the Twitter page. So all in all, it was a good week. Yeah. At Faithless MTG, that's where you can get all the latest.
Also joining us is Damon Alexander from Seattle. Damon, how's life?
Hey, it's good. It's a little, you know, gray day here, but the weekend was nice. Managed to both play in a tournament and also go hiking, so I had a good time. How are things with you, Dave?
Hanging in there, just trying to make it through a short week and get the 4th of July festivities started.
Oh, yeah.
So it was a busy day in the modern world this weekend. We had two major events. We had the GP Dallas-Fort Worth, which was one of the first actual filmed GPs we've had in quite a while. There were some interesting decks that made the top 8 there, as well as the SCG Team Open, which sort of showcased the maybe new modern metagame even more so, with a large showing for Hogak and the UR Phoenix. Dan, what were your impressions of some of the metagame, day 2 metagame scenarios?
So I think the question on everyone's mind going into this weekend was, like, will this be, like, GP Hogak? That was, like, a meme they kept coming back to on the coverage. Was Hogak Bridgevine just going to crush the events? Or were people going to, just, like, show up with some brilliant counter strategies? And the answer, I think, was kind of both and. Like, Hogak did crush the event, and people also seemed to have decks they liked that they were happy to play against it. So Hogak had respectable showing. I want to say, what, 2 in the top 8 at the Grand Prix, and it was on the winning team at the Star City Games Team Open, but it was actually Phoenix was probably the most successful deck at that event, followed by Hogak.
Well, on the GP side, I feel like Hogak was a little bit more successful than Is It Phoenix, so somehow the SCG Team Open had a slightly much larger Phoenix presence.
Yeah, and I think that kind of gets to this issue of, like, what do we learn from these two events specifically? And it used to be the case that, you know, Grand Prix as, like, these prestige events were what we would look to every week, every 2 weeks to sort of see, like, keep track of what's going on in the metagame. But organized play has been in such a weird place of transition and turmoil that, like, the Star City circuit is, I think, a little bit more of a focused tour at this point. And the people who are SCG regulars, like, go to all the Star City events and have, like, testing teams, whereas a Grand Prix, I think, is becoming more like a regional local event, like a regional championship, where I would venture that the field was a little more random at the Grand Prix, whereas at the Star City event, it was a team non-unified modern, so you could show up with 3 of the same decks, and a number of teams did that. They just all had a Phoenix list that they really liked, and there were, like, 3 Phoenix teams. Or sorry, like, each seat was playing Phoenix, or each seat was playing Bridgevine. So in that sense, like, I kind of feel like the Star City event gives like a better snapshot of what like the grinder class thinks is like the current meta, whereas the Grand Prix is like a little bit more of like a people's tournament in some way. Would you guys agree with that?
I think you used some hilarious political weasel words to describe what WotC has done to their competitive Magic scene. But sure, yeah, if we're choosing to bolderize the real words, yes, they've created a scene of some turmoil. And yeah, they've vaporized the grinder class to dust. And without them, yeah, I think maybe you're right that GPs are a little, I don't want to say casual, but maybe less focused. I do think that the Team Open is a little also altered, because when you play in a team, I think it's a lot harder to kind of convince the two other teammates to let you do something off the wall or brew or pursue something, or even harder to convince yourself if you kind of want to play it safe because you don't want to let your teammates down. So I think both of them have strong arguments maybe for not being the most indicative what the Mythic Championship might be if there were no bans.
So you're saying that every team at the SCG event, all, you know, they all have one player who's like, I'm going to play ninjas. And then the other two players are like, no, you're not. You're playing Phoenix. Get back there.
I could imagine a dynamic if I was on a team. I would not want to play Hogak or Phoenix. But if someone's saying, look, we're traveling to this tournament, we're investing a lot of time, you know, we really want you to at least, you know, set up some kind of conditions. Like, you're going to have to beat us X amount of times out of 10 or 25 to be able to play your pet brew. Otherwise, you have to lock in, you know, one of these three or four decks that we consider to sort of be tier one. Or it seems like maybe these two decks are the top tier.
Dan, just to go back to what you're saying, you're kind of saying that like the SCG event overall, like day ones of a GP can be pretty open, and then day two tends to be much more focused on the top tier meta decks. And you're saying that maybe SCG, like the day one experience, is much more like the GP day two experience?
Yeah, I think that basically captures the dynamic. I don't want to say that the day one of the Star City Games is more competitive, but the day two certainly is. There's sort of two factors. One, it's a smaller tournament, and very few people have any buys going to that event. So the cut for day two, I think, is usually you need to go 7-2, which in a Grand Prix is a huge event, and a lot of people have two or three buys. At an SCG, most people are starting with zero or one buy, so the day two field might only have like 25 teams or something like that. And the conversion rates are much more stark drop-off. Like, the rogue decks just didn't make it to day two at the Star City, whereas the field of, like, miscellaneous stuff is always well-represented at a Grand Prix. And you just go down the list of, like, who is in day two at a Star City, and, you know, these are, like, known names from the SCG Tour. But I think one of the best examples of how these tournaments differ is one of the decks that made top eight at Dallas-Fort Worth, the Grand Prix, was this Taking Turns deck piloted by Daniel Wong, who is sort of famous for being the taking turns guy, the quadruple sleeved taking turns deck. Somehow he does really well with it. He's had
He has had great results in multiple different sort of metagames, so kudos to him.
Yeah, and I think, you know, all three of us, when we saw this result, we're like, oh, maybe, you know, there's like a little flash of hope. Like, maybe he's cracked it. Maybe there's still hope for, you know, the offbeat decks that are still competitive. Well, he actually posted a tournament report, and one of the questions he addressed was, how does my deck beat Hogak? And, well, do you want to guess what the answer was?
It doesn't. I looked at it. He doesn't actually have that much graveyard haste.
Right. So his answer was, he doesn't beat Hogak. He just hoped to dodge it. And it turned out that in his very first round of the GP, he had a couple buys. He got an unintentional draw, which put him in the draw bracket at this huge tournament. And then every round was playing against these control decks, mid-range and control decks. So he didn't play against Hogak until round 14 out of 15, where he got crushed. So yeah, like, it turns out that was a brilliant strategy. You know, if you don't want to face Hogak, just stall out in your first round, play at a leisurely pace, get yourself that draw, and then you're probably safe from Hogak, because they're all getting lunch already. They've stomped their opponents pretty quickly, or been stomped.
And especially if you're taking all the turns, you have a lot of control over how long each turn takes.
He's a clean player.
He is, absolutely. We're certainly not implicating him. He played quite quickly in a little bit that I watched.
So that's the kind of thing where, yeah, we, even looking at these big events, we can't be too results-oriented when we're trying to make sense of, like, what's actually, like, doing well in the meta. So what's your guys' overall assessment of, like, what do we take away from these two tournaments? Are the fears justified? Like, is this format functioning? Is it broken? Is it healthy? Is there a problem here?
I guess I think that based on what they saw, the Wizards is not actually going to ban Hogak because all they can do is look at raw numbers. They don't have any intuition at all into how like modern plays. And Hogak does not look, if you just look at the numbers, to be that dominating. And it chased away a bunch of other decks that people hate playing. So sure, people hate losing to Hogak. They hate losing to lots of combo decks. But they also hate losing to Tron, etc. And you don't have anyone like bitching about Tron anymore, which was a big concern with the London Mulligan rule happening. So my guess is they're going to say like, oh, you know, a bunch of Merfolk decks, you know, top 32 because they were playing whatever. And they will expect the pros to deal with it. That's my guess. And I think that is the wrong takeaway. I think certainly a card from Hogak needs to be banned. I think we had talked about Bridge from Below being the most likely candidate. And with the London Mulligan rule, I think maybe they need to take a card from the Allosaurus Rider deck.
Yeah, I mean, one takeaway that I have is just that Hogak did really well. It had a really good conversion rate, had a very high meta presence. And this is in a meta where people are playing way more Graveyard Hate than they ever did. I mean, even when Dredge was kind of the deck to beat along with Phoenix, you wouldn't see blue-white decks packing four Rest in Pieces and main deck Surgicals. Like, they come, you know, maybe run a couple Surgicals and then have two to three Rest in Pieces. But now they're really maxing out on this hate. And Hogak still did really well in the spite of all this.
Although I do think they can't. They've kind of tied their hands to the point where I don't expect anything to get banned in the next announcement, which I believe is next week. I think that we're going to be stuck with this metagame at least until after the Pro Tour, and possibly longer. The deck didn't sweep the event, and I think it would have taken something exceptional like that for them to issue what would amount to an emergency ban, which they said they wouldn't do. It just hasn't been out long enough.
Yeah, on the other hand, I mean, they have this data set that we have really no insight into, and that's the MTGO. Every match played, they can probably classify decks into is it Hogak or not, and look at all the Hogak win rates. And I suspect that on MTGO, like, it just must have an insane win rate.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's certainly doing well against me online, despite my efforts.
I think it is worth noting, too, when you see decks at 5-0 that aren't Hogak, and of course they artificially generate, I mean, these lists are not artificial, but because they intentionally choose cards that have X amount of difference, you don't get to see like a 50 Hogak decks 5-0 and then like one each of all these random pet decks 5-0. It's like they publish six decks and the illusion of a variety is preserved. These listed 5-0 have like 6 to 7 pieces of graveyard hate in their 75. So, you know, you can't control what Wizards does. They're going to ban or not ban. But if they don't ban, then I think the takeaway is if you don't want to play Hogak, first of all, if you want to play Hogak, you should really practice with it. The deck is very complicated. It is not a brainless combo like people in chat like to say. There's lots of decision points. Two, if you want to play against it, you want to play a list that can comfortably main deck some amount of graveyard hate to give you a shot in game one. And then you need, 6 or 7 pieces in your 75. So,
yeah, I think that's a great point. You can see if you watch some of the camera matches is that these Hogak decks, they end up playing games 2 and 3. So game it's a great game one deck. Game one, they usually win in like a landslide. But games 2 and 3 are much different. They tend to play those games in the fail state, if we use that phrase, where they're not keeping a hand based on how explosive it is. They're basically keeping something on the assumption that the opponent is going to just be disrupting them, either with something, a strong piece, like a ley line or a rest in peace, or with like multiple small pieces. And those end up being like really kind of interesting games where you have to chip in with these small creatures, get your value off Carrion Feeder, get them under 10s, so the Bloodghast has haste, things like that. It's an interesting dynamic in its own way. I mean, it's kind of frustrating at the same time, but it's definitely...
It's miserable. It's like you have no chance to win, but it also takes them forever to do so because they have to be very meticulous, especially, as you say, in game 2 and 3. So there's just millions of little operations where they mill and cast and fetch. And like watching people play Hogak, I watched Yuta Takahashi, the fairies guru who abandoned fairies because it's unplayable in this meta. And he just took forever to take all these turns where very little happened, and he ended up losing. But still, it just the combo player ends up taking so much of the clock because he's considering all these hierarchical decision trees.
Yeah, another name that I noticed was Tom Ross in the top 8 of Grand Prix Dallas Fort Worth, who, as we talked about before, was one of the lead developers of Modern Horizons. And you know, he writes for Star City Games. He was excited about cards like Ranger Captain of EOS, Force of Virtue. These are kind of like Tom Ross cards because he's known for his work on Martyr Proc and Infect. So he made top 8, and he was not playing Force of Virtue.
He was not playing
Ranger Captain.
He was not playing Ranger Captain.
He was playing Hogak. Just
This was the end game the entire time.
Yeah.
He had circled this event on his calendar. The cash in with the Hogak deck.
Yeah, but one takeaway is that even though Hogak did well, it's clear that Blue White Control and Phoenix are both clearly tier one decks right now, and they're very powerful, and they can compete with Hogak. And so if you don't want to play Hogak and you really want to just maximize your chances of winning, picking up one of those decks is definitely a pretty solid decision to make. As we saw with the SCG Tour, maybe everybody made their teammates do that.
Yeah, there wasn't quite as much blue-white control, but definitely there was lots of Phoenix. I think there was more Phoenix than Hogak in day two by quite a bit. So
yeah, blue-white ended up winning the Grand Prix.
Yes, and had another copy, almost an identical 75 in the top eight.
And it's also, I mean, it's been winning the challenges and doing really well in them, all the Moto events. There's actually just like this one list that somebody came up with, and I forget the guy's name, but he finished first in one of the events and second in the other event in one weekend. And then that just appears to be the new Blue-White 75.
Yeah, that was a MTGO player named by the name of Doom Switch. So yeah, I think there's like a lot going on beneath the surface. And I know that we've been talking a lot about Hogak, and so has everyone else, but the modern format beyond that has really undergone some major shifts. It's almost like the format has rotated, which is not necessarily a good thing. You know, this was ostensibly a non-rotating format where your favorite decks could just be played. That just might not be true anymore. Blue-white has just massively leveled up with these new cards from War of the Spark and now Modern Horizons. And we're seeing archetypes that just didn't exist before. Like, the Artifact deck is now like an Urza Goblin Engineer deck that has been doing quite well, kind of quietly. It had a good performance at the Star City events as well. And some of the familiar players like Tron just they're just temporarily gone. And that all may change again. The London Mulligan has been instituted as of today. So another mini rotation is happening. So yeah, there's just so much turmoil right now. A lot of change happening.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly seems like what doesn't rotate is that Faithless Looting is a strong card, and so is Mox Opal. Ancient Stirrings has taken a bit of a break right now, it seems, but those two cornerstone cards are still very much there.
Stirrings has been working hard. It earned a break, I think.
Yeah.
So, Dan, in the face of this combo summer, you decided to bring good old Rock, Nothing Beats Rock, to a ICQ this weekend?
Yeah, I was playing at just a local 1K, a Star City Invitational Qualifier. This was at Newington, Connecticut. And for whatever reason, like in my area, there are a lot of 1Ks. So you start to see the same people at all these things. And I've come to expect that there's like a ton of Amulet players and a ton of blue-white players in any of these tournaments. And then there's like some percentage who are switching to whatever the current best deck is. So even if I'm thinking like, oh, well, there's probably going to be a good turnout for Hogak, there's always going to be blue-white people and a lot of people who switch between Amulet and blue-white. I think it's something about the Northeast. Like, there's a lot of big brain players who like feeling in control of their destiny. In that field, I had been doing well with a green-black Grim Flayer build. I made a couple top eights with that. And so I thought, you know, this seems fine. Like, last weekend, black-based mid-range decks had a surprisingly, like, quietly good showing on Magic Online, where if you were willing to play some Nihil Spellbombs main deck and then supplement that with Ley Lines or some stronger hate in the sideboard, you know, you could win with something like Green Black or Jund. And one of the events was won by Jund. Green Black put a couple in the top eight. So I figure, you know, why not? It's like, I always feel like I played good Magic when I show up with the gold Grim Flayer Rock. So I gave it a little tune up and it went about the way that one would expect. I didn't win a lot of the matches that I could have won. Just to give you an idea, so I played five rounds in the tournament. I played against Blue-Black Fairies, Hogak, Is It Phoenix, Blue-White Control, and Green-White Devoted Vizier. So, like, just if I had known in advance that I was going to play against those decks, like, would I have played Green-Black? I mean, yeah, why not? It's one of those seductive decks where you can imagine that you have a game plan against any particular deck, any given deck you're going to face, where you can think, I'm going to side out these cards, side in these cards, and, you know, I'll have something to combat them. Just once the game starts, like, this, you know, the devil's in the details, and the green-black deck does not have very many ways to draw additional cards or filter through a stack to find the sideboard cards. ironically, Grim Flayer is one of the best cards for that purpose, and it's the card that is kind of like the rogue tech where people don't even play that usually. So you end up losing these matches where it's like, huh, well, I lost, I was beaten, but I'm not totally sure that was a bad matchup. It was like a 50-50 matchup, possibly a 47-53 matchup. And maybe if I play a little better or sideboard a little smarter, I could have been 52-48, but like, this was one of the ones I lost. So I ended up going 2-3. And, you know, I felt like I learned what I wanted to learn at that point, which is that the deck is still fine. I mean, the new cards were good. Like, I was playing Plague Engineer in some quantity, and that guy was very good. He was useful in almost every matchup. I played against Hogak, and I even won game one on the draw, which sounds impossible, right? And then I lost games 2 and 3, like, just I couldn't find any lands. I mulled to 5 twice, and it was like extra frustrating because, you know, the Hogak player, they're like, ah, now you're being punished for mulliganing to ley lines. And I wasn't mulliganing to ley lines. I just couldn't find lands. And so I died. So that was like a little bit disappointing, where I didn't feel like there's anything wrong with the deck per se, but the deck also like wasn't inherently favored in any matchup. So it was like a fine-ish choice. It's not like a secret way to beat the meta. And I think we kind of saw that this weekend where, you know, Green, Black, and Jund just didn't really make any noise at these big tournaments we were talking about. They're out there and they're fine.
Yeah, it always feels like these Green, Black decks are, I mean, they're famous for being the kind of 50-50 decks of the format. And so it feels like your odds of top eighting are, you know, 1/2 to the whatever number of wins are required to make top 8.
Yeah, I think that sums it up. One takeaway that I had was that because blue-white is so prevalent in my local area, and also just like it's doing quite well, you do need Dark Confidants. And I was playing without them for reasons I don't want to get into right now.
That ends up I'm trying to convince you to play more of them. I was like, Green Black needs card draw. You have one piece of card draw in there.
Okay, well, the short reason I don't play them is that I don't own any, and I've been winning without them. So I, you know, for that reason, talked myself into like, I don't need them. Right? but now I'm starting to see like there are some prominent matchups where like that would be the best possible card. By contrast, Liliana of the Veil, her stock has really decreased. She is often just not even good in the matches where she used to be good, like against blue-white. She's no longer even necessarily a good card that you even want. You'll play her, and you'll be upticking, trying to, you know, hack away at both players' resources, but you'll be discarding your Assassin's Trophy, and they'll be discarding a Plains. And then, like, if they ever, at any point, if they top deck a Narset or a Teferi, they're just going to, like, rocket ahead of you. So it's a tough nut to crack. Weirdly enough, Tireless Tracker, which is a card that I had been down on, but I think you guys were both higher on it. It tends to be one of the best tools now. Its stock has gone back up.
I gave this exact feedback then. I was like, I don't think Liliana of the Veil is very well positioned right now. I don't think he was worth running a full playset of them, of her.
You're Prophet Cassandra. You can see the future, but you're powerless to stop it. You tried to warn me. I did cut Liliana for an extra tracker at your suggestion, and that was very good, but I possibly just need more. It's just weird to think of playing Green Black X without, not even without the full number of Liliana, but playing that deck with the expectation that Liliana is not even a card we want to draw. And at that point, you sort of wonder, like, where is the power coming from? And it turns out that, like, yeah, it may be coming from other sources, like Seasoned Pyromancer or Ren and Six. Like, that's where the successful Jund builds are turning now, at the expense of Liliana. So, interesting stuff. I've always felt like Green-Black in particular needed a facelift, and there's definitely like iteration, some brewing, some tuning to be done there. If you're interested in this deck archetype, don't feel like you need to play like whatever the stock list is. Like, there is no stock list, and it needs to be, if there is one, it really needs to be like reinvented. It's perhaps been like falling behind the pace relative to the field.
And if you want to get really crazy, I think you could start playing like uncomfortable amount of Graveyard Hate main and just rely on the Seasoned Pyromancer to kind of filter them away when you don't need them. I think that's an angle that more people should be trying. Like, you can start main decking like 3 Nile Spellbomb or multiple ley lines, and if you don't draw them in your opening hand or it's too late to play them, you can always just filter them away if you're playing more of the Seasoned Pyromancer.
Yeah, somehow Nihil Spellbomb is just like the one of the best main deck Graveyard Hate pieces. Relic of Progenitus puts up a nice fight, but it's just very distant second because it requires 2 mana to play and activate, whereas Spellbomb just requires 1. I can tell you I've lost a lot of games because I didn't have that 1 mana up for Relic.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very real cost to the point that, and Hogak fills the graveyard so quickly, you know, 1 card a turn is fine against decks where you're trying to, like, whatever, bother Lingering Souls or something like that, but it just, Hogak is so explosive. A lot of times, like you say, Damon, the mana requirements mean you can't advance your own game plan while still trying to make sure you can remove the graveyard in a timely fashion.
Right, right. But yeah, one interesting direction for Jund is the Dreadhorde Arcanist's Crashing Footfall synergy, which I ran into at a Legacy 1K, and is quite powerful, really. And so I'm curious to see if that ever starts making more headway. I know people have tried it, but nothing's really seems to be making like top 8s these days with it.
Get a couple of thick boys Crashing Footfalls.
Yep, they have Trample, and they are 4/4.
It's important to have a pretty big board presence when you get milled out the following turn, so I think that's the way to...
Yeah.
Yeah. But you're spot on about Nihil Spellbomb. I was playing 3-man deck, and that was arguably I should be playing 4. The Grixis Urza decks that were doing pretty well online and at the SCG event were also playing a large number of Spellbombs and sometimes Tormod's Crypts.
Plus so, the ability to search for them, so it's really like they're playing, you know, 6 or 7 main.
Right, you can get Goblin Engineer with just looping 2 spell bombs. It's a thing that I saw happen. But yeah, I mean, you need something like that that can nuke the graveyard without costing you mana. And then you just need to do that again and again and again if you're going to try to keep up with a game 1 Hogak deck.
So I think that's kind of all for the state of Modern. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back with the analysis of our flashback list from last week when we tried to explore some angles with one of Tom Ross's favorite cards, Force of Virtue.
Nice.
All right, welcome back to our flashback from last week where we talk about what we brewed with Force of Virtue and how those lists performed. We mainly tried 3 fundamental shells. One was a mono-white goat list featuring Elesh Norn and Springjack Shepherd. Is that the guy's name?
Yeah, that's right.
And then the next was a Mardu Pyrohawk list that Dave piloted. It's basically a Mardu shell with a lot of token makers that Force of Virtue helps boost. And then I tried an Esper Skies list featuring, again, a bunch of token makers and then an old Pro Tour champion, Judge's Familiar. And the most powerful synergy in all of the lists that kind of hold them in common was the Squadron Hawk Force of Virtue interaction. I think all of our lists featured both as a 4 of. And I'd like to lead off the discussion with Dave's Mardu Pyrohawk list. Would you like to discuss how that went, Dave?
Yeah, so I went 2-3 in 2 different leagues. It's weird. The deck actually felt great. The Force of Virtue interaction is maybe not as necessary in this list because you do try to sort of grind them out. And you win so late in the game that the extra power isn't all that relevant. One time I did draw the nut draw of like removal spell, Squadron Hawk on 2, Seasoned Pyromancer on 3, discard the 2 Hawks, and then on their turn I had flashed in Force of Virtue, and I just crushed blue-white control, like it wasn't close. So I don't know if you'd want to like design the list to try to do that more often, because I was not playing the full 4 Force of Virtue. But I think the generic shell for like the Mardu control kind of list is reasonable. And the Squadron Hawk just filling up your hand to get turned into extra cards for Faithless Looting and Seasoned Pyromancer just felt really good. The negatives are that the closing speed of the deck is pretty slow and that there's just so much graveyard hate around that like all your extra synergies people have sideboard for. So like you're never going to get to flashback of Lingering Souls, really. You're never going to get to use the Seasoned Pyromancer's ability from the graveyard. So maybe it's not good in this particular metagame, but against every fair deck, I just felt so far ahead. I just crushed a bunch of sort of like Sultai, Jund kind of builds. I was just up so many cards, there's nothing they could do about it.
Yeah, honestly, if your graveyard dependencies are only like Lingering Souls and Seasoned Pyromancer, if somebody like takes the time and a card to play Rest in Peace, sometimes it actually feels pretty good. It doesn't hurt you enough to make it worth it.
Yeah, and I think the fact that like your card engine, if you will, is Squadron Hawk instead of the 8 mana 3/4 guy that discards your hand and draws 3 really makes
Bedlam Reveler.
Yeah, Bedlam Reveler makes you a lot less vulnerable to that kind of thing. I did lose to Hogak twice. You know, I just you mulligan to try to find your pieces, and at a certain point, you just have to like keep a playable hand at 5 or 4. But you know, it is what it is. I think the list needs a little bit of tweaking. I guess I would get rid of the Force of Virtues and play a couple other cards, but Seasoned Pyromancer was amazing, and everybody should be playing this card. It just seems really good.
Yeah, the card's price has been spiking up recently, so it feels like that is definitely a trend other people are on.
So you mentioned closing speed being an issue. So did the Force of Virtue not help in that respect, or was it just not worth a card?
It always felt like a win more, yeah. So when it was in play, it was always nice to have. But I think you could kind of go two ways. You could kind of lean into the fact that you're a little bit more of a control deck, although, again, you're a control deck without counter spells, so that's always dicey. And sort of abandon the Force of Virtue and just play like more value cards and try to get more value out of your Seasoned Pyromancer. Or you could be like a full-on, like a jank tokens kind of list that plays Seasoned Pyromancer on three and plays a full four Force of Virtue and a bunch of other like token-making cards. Maybe even like it's two and two white, it makes two birds, and then you can exile it from your graveyard. If you tap three white creatures and make two more.
Battle Screech.
Yeah, like almost go full on tokens and just use like Seasoned Pyromancer to filter through your deck, which is a ability that those decks are often lacking, or refuel your hand. The problem is you also kind of want Faithless Looting as another sort of Seasoned Pyromancer 5-8. As soon as you do that, then I don't think you want to be on tokens. So there's some tensions there to resolve, but the interaction between Seasoned Pyromancer and Squadron Hawk felt insane. Like if you could just sculpt every hand to go discard spell, Squadron Hawk, Seasoned Pyromancer, those games just, you're just ahead so many cards. Now, what the rest of your deck has to be around that to sort of turn that advantage into something useful is not yet known to me.
So did you find that you were able to like leverage the discard spells? You know, I think you were playing three Thought Seize, three Inquisition. Were you able to slow the game down enough to the point where like these 1/1 and 2/2 creatures, like you could actually cast them without falling so far behind and like actually make them relevant bodies? Or was it more like the game was decided by the disruption and then eventually you went with the tokens?
Because that's what you have. Like, Squadron Hawk was just like a great card against blue-white. it just refills your hand. It gives you a bunch of stuff to do. You know, with a couple creatures in play, eventually they just have to Wrath, and then you cast a Seasoned Pyromancer and fill up your board with one card again that also replenishes your hand. And in the late game, Seasoned Pyromancer turns all your bad discard spells, like the one time they're bad is on turn 6, and literally anything else. The other thing is Seasoned Pyromancer also helps you draw to your sideboard cards. The problem is a lot of times like a deck like Kolgak is killing you before you get a fourth turn. But against like a more reasonable combo deck, it filters away stuff that's bad, you know, in that matchup or in that situation and helps find, in theory, the other cards you want.
Yeah, and also it looks like your sideboard is a little bit light on Hogak hate, and so maybe just a little bit more of that would be helpful.
Yeah, I mean, I've got five pieces of graveyard hate.
Yeah, but they're not the Hogak killers. You only have two Ravenous Trap. You're going to want some like ley lines, I think. Kai's guy was a little bit too slow.
I mean, I used to just never put ley lines in my sideboard because they were a $60 card. I didn't own any, so reasons to not play them. But it's July 2019. Ley lines have just been reprinted. The London Mulligan makes ley lines even better than they ever were before. So the time is now to just suck it up, buy some ley lines, and just put them into decks like this. And I'm guilty of that too. I didn't play them this past weekend, for example. Yeah, I think that would help. Like until we get rid of this deck, we should be taking advantage of the strongest black hate.
Yeah. So I guess my takeaway is that there's something really interesting here. It might be a little too clunky for how fast Modern is. I think that's very possible. You want to play a lot of one mana spells that can either affect the hand or the board because you are going to sometimes be a little tempo negative. But yeah, like as far as like a built-in card value engine that doesn't cost you a lot of slots, it felt great. And there's definitely something to the shell there, and I need to do a little bit more work, I think, to tease out the most that you can get out of that.
I know what I would do. I would cut the Young Pyromancers and the Judith, the Scourge Diva, and just play more Smiting Helix and maybe a couple extra Collective Brutality, because I think Smiting Helix is amazing. And
you Smiting Helix was actually a really bad card for me. It was just so slow, so clunky. It's like bad against some of the creature combo decks. Like I'm sitting there trying to cast these 4-mana sorceries against the kill a creature against like the Devoted Druid combo.
That should be a good matchup for Smiting Helix. I don't know what to tell you. I think that's just variance. I think it's a great card against Devoted Druid.
No, it wasn't. So I don't. But yeah, I mean, there's definitely, like I said, there's definitely avenues to pursue. So
yeah, that's a list where the Squadron Hawks are maybe like the featured upgrade to what we think of as like a Mardu Pyromancer deck, and the Force of Virtue maybe fits or maybe doesn't.
Unclear if it's an upgrade or not, but something different anyway.
So I was trying a list that really wanted to draw Force of Virtue pretty frequently. So I was playing the Goat Devotion or Spring Jack Shepherd Mono White Devotion list. You know, what makes it a devotion list is that it has some number of Nykthos. I ended up playing the full four by the later iterations. So we're really interested in white pips, and Force of Virtue gives you two white pips for zero mana. On top of that, there are cards like Ranger Captain of Eos, which has two white pips conveniently, and also helps with something that white has really traditionally struggles with, which is drawing cards. So between Squadron Hawk and Ranger Captain of Eos, I was trying to have enough cards to be able to keep up in matchups that were about grind, see enough cards to like actually get my synergies up and running, and also like have expendable cards to pitch to the Force of Virtue. So I went into this kind of thinking that I was going to get blown out. You know, we're interested in competitive brews that are capable of actually 5-0ing in a league. This one is more of like a pet casual deck. I wasn't expecting too much from it, except for like some, you know, highlight reel type stuff. It was actually like pretty good. I ended up playing a few different iterations, like four leagues total, and I think I went like 12-8 or something like that. But I was expecting to be going significantly worse than that. So, and in those eight losses, you know, some of them were Hogak losses where, you know, I tried. I did what I could. But the deck was a lot better than I expected. And the Force of Virtue in particular was a lot better than I expected.
From watching your game, actually, the card that I thought was the MVP that was a surprise was Elesh Norn.
Yeah,
that card was just like lights out against a lot of decks. I mean, I remember just watching you playing as Merfolk, and I think two games in a row, Elesh Norn hit the stack, and it didn't even resolve before the scoop happened.
Yeah, and that's like a more fringe deck. But if you can resolve Elesh Norn against Hogak, like, you are safe. Like, you've basically won the game. I know that sounds weird, and it would take a while to get Elesh Norn in play, but basically any deck in the format is soft-ish to Elesh Norn. And if you're kind of wondering how can that be true, well, think about the card Plague Engineer, which a lot of people are really high on, justifiably so, which can give -1/-1 to creature type of your choice. And that, you know, is great against humans, like humans kind of fold to that. It's great against any kind of tribal deck. But even things like the Urza Thopter Sword combo is shut down by a single Plague Engineer. Well, it turns out that Urza Thopter Sword also folds to an Elesh Norn, and you can kill them possibly the same turn you cast it, which I got to do a couple times. Elesh Norn just feels amazing right now. So that was the one that was bouncing between two and three copies, and eventually in my most successful build, where I went 4-1 with, was actually a full four copies of Elesh Norn. So I think this deck gets like a tentative endorsement from me. I think that the change I had to make was accepting that Spring Jack Shepherd is not necessarily a main deck card, or certainly not a main deck four of. There were matchups where it was just truly outstanding, and you get like all these 1/2s or 2/3s sometimes if you have two Force of Virtues. But that was a small chunk of the metagame is decided by creature combat. So many matchups are decided by other things, and they don't really care what your four mana creature is because the game will have been fought over something else in the early turns. So I actually moved the Spring Jack Shepherds to the sideboard in my last league run and was just trying to maximize like a turbo Elesh Norn build where in the slots that used to belong to Spring Jack Shepherd, I gave those to Leyline of Sanctity instead, which is another one of those Feast or Famine home run type cards where it might just win the game on turn one or it might do nothing. But it does contribute to devotion in any case. And you can always pitch the extra copies to Force of Virtue, which I did a couple times as well.
Yeah, and also, if you really just like to be able to beat Tier 1 decks, maybe not with a good win rate, but just be able to beat them sometimes in a really funny way, I would say Springjack Shepherd really does not disappoint. I watched some of those games, and watching a Jund opponent have to figure out how to deal with like 7-1-2 goats, it was just a delight.
Yeah, so it's somewhere between hilarious meme tribal deck and like sneakily competitive in need of a tune-up deck. So I will post sort of the best version that I think I arrived at, which maximized Elesh Norn and ended up maximizing Walking Ballista. And I think this is something that we've come across a lot already on our podcast, and is something that comes up a lot when you're trying to brew around like a synergy, is that you need payoffs that still function when you don't have your synergies up and running. And Walking Ballista is kind of the perfect card for that, where I'm trying to set up this board state where I have a Nykthos and a ton of mana, but you know, I can't count on that. So Ballista worked at all stages of the game, including just playing it for zero to kill a bridge from below, which I had to do a bunch of times as well. The fact that Ranger Captain finds Ballista, so you have functionally eight copies, ended up making the deck like more playable than one might expect.
Yeah, I'm surprised actually that you went with so many copies of Walking Ballista and Weather Wayfarer with Ranger Captain to help try to find them. It's more of like a toolbox versus just a, I want four of these. Another thing that struck me was that in our early testing with that deck, it seemed like the card Winds of Abandon from Modern Horizons was actually a card that maybe was originally dismissed. I thought it wasn't very good. It's like a sorcery speed path and then has this ridiculous overload cost. But in the matches I was watching, it frequently became like one of the most live cards to draw in a lot of situations where, you know, sorcery speed path is still a powerful effect, still a pretty good removal spell. And then the overload would be a one-sided plague wind effect. But also you basically went really down on that card for On Thin Ice, another Modern Horizons card. What was going on with that one?
Yeah, you make a great point. And there ended up being like embarrassment of riches in the removal category, which sounds weird for a white deck because you think of white and it's like, well, there's path and maybe Declaration in Stone. You can throw away your copies of Declaration in Stone now. The card is very obsolete because On Thin Ice is legit. Like, that card is great. And Winds of Abandon is also great. So I was kind of torn on, like, should I be playing Paths? Should I be playing On Thin Ice? Path is instant speed, and it can help you if you are trying to use the... There's this weird dynamic in the deck where you have Knight of the White Orchid and Weather Wayfarer, where you kind of want to be behind on lands in order to activate their abilities. But if you don't have them, like, On Thin Ice is a clean kill. It doesn't give the opponent card advantage. It doesn't ramp the opponent. It contributes to your own devotion, which is huge. I think they're both fine cards, both Path and On Thin Ice. You can play some number of either one. Winds of Abandon, I was playing between 1, 3, and 0 copies, depending on which league run I was doing. In the end, I ended up feeling like it kind of lived in the same space as Elesh Norn and Walking Ballista. It's like, these are just like big cards that can handle opposing creatures. Like, I have enough of that already. So I'm not ready to like endorse one or the other. I think they're just all great options.
And this is another list that could main deck Rest in Peace very easily, you know, some amount, depending on how much hate you want to play in your main deck.
Yeah, absolutely. For the same reason that you can main deck Leyland of Sanctity.
Exactly.
Yeah, and honestly, I mean, like, Pitches to Force is a bit of a, like, meme or something. But somehow it is true that if you draw multiple Force of Virtues, you can just pitch one to the other. This happened a lot for me. If you draw a Path against a blue-white deck, it's not necessary. You just pitch that. If you draw Leyline, I imagine you could pitch those if they're not needed.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting that to actually play out, but it really did. You know, I was pitching extra copies of Elesh Norn, pitching Border Posts, pitching just any random card, and then getting the cards back by, you know, playing a Ranger Captain. And then it just turns out that there's like, yeah, these little mini synergies, like Squadron Hawk becomes a little bit real, becomes like a 2-2 flyer. Walking Ballista, you can play it on zero mana and it's still a 1-1. So yeah, surprisingly versatile deck. And one that I expect I will play more just because it's a lot of fun. And I think there's still some solving to be done in the one slot. I think Weather Wayfarer was the card that I was the least happy with. I have between 0 and 4 copies, depending on which league I was playing. It's kind of nice to have one as a tutor target, but they're not reliable. So if I can find a better solution in the one mana slot, I think Thraben Inspector is the best card that I've found. I think there might be something here. So we tried one further shell, and this was again using the Squadron Hawk Force of Virtue interaction, but here we were interested in the idea that, well, Squadron Hawk is a flyer, so what if we just put a bunch of flyers together and pump them all? So Damon, you tried a league with this, what we call the Esper Skies. Do you want to tell us a bit about how that went for you?
Yeah, so this list basically runs a lot of flying creatures and token makers that make flying creatures. So the main creatures are four of each of Judge's Familiar, Mausoleum Wanderer, Pride of the Clouds, and Squadron Hawk, and then a set of four of Lingering Souls and Spectral Procession, and then four Force of Virtue, and then four removal spells, some Smuggler's Copters, some Bitter Blossoms, a couple Planeswalkers, and 22 lands to round it out. And the deck went 3-2. Possibly it should have been a 2-3 because my Devoted Druid opponent in one round, I think they had a win available to them and they just kind of missed it. But I beat Four Color Kiki, I beat Blue Eye Control and Devoted Druid, and I lost to Humans and Jeskai Saheeli. The Saheeli matchup was rough. I kind of just didn't get the right draws, and they had their combo with Redundancy in game one. But I'm not sure that the deck felt super good. I mean, three of the opponents I was on were playing these infinite combo decks, and I was playing Pride of the Clouds. Just to refresh everybody's memory, Pride of the Clouds is white-blue for a 1-1 flyer. It is an elemental cat, which is just weird. And it gets +1/+1 for each other creature with flying on the battlefield. So just like, what was it, Radiant from Urza's Legacy?
Radiant Archangel.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I like loved that card as a kid. I just thought it was so cool. You know, who needs Sarah Angel? This guy'd be like an 8-8 in multiplayer. But yeah, and Pride of the Clouds has this forecast text, which we can probably just skip because it really isn't very good. But for 4 mana during your upkeep, you can reveal it to let your opponent know that this elemental cat is about to feast on them and they can get a little bit scared. And it creates a 1-1 white and blue bird creature token with flying. So the deck is just trying to disassemble a lot of flying creatures and a lot of flying tokens and then get a Force of Virtue or these Planeswalkers, Sarah the Benevolent or Sorin, both can give your guys a boost of power. And then use that to swing in, hopefully to kill your opponent quite quickly. What felt good about the deck was that was true, and so frequently you could clear out Planeswalkers quite easily with your multiple creatures. That was why Blue-White felt winnable, was because that deck just, they can only really answer Spectral Procession or Lingering Souls effectively with Wrath effects. What felt weak was just that, you know, Pride of the Clouds and Judge's Familiar and some of the other cards just didn't really do a whole lot. And actually, sometimes, like, I actually almost lost a race to Devoted Druid, which is kind of crazy, because Devoted Druid deck does not want to race. It wants to kill you with infinite damage. But somehow, they play their 1 and a green for Duskwatch Recruiter, and it's a 2-2 for 2, and you play 1 and a white for a Squadron Hog, which is a 1-1 for 2, and you're already losing the race. And so you actually would lean on the Force of Virtue, which I couldn't always draw, and that was actually a card that felt really good in this list, to help create a reasonable clock out of nowhere. And against like Blue White, sometimes I would get multiple of these in play, and all of a sudden every creature is a huge threat to both them and to their Planeswalkers. The thing is, I'm just not really sure like what the deck needs to make it to the next level. I'm not really sure that the deck felt totally fixable in a sense. I would probably cut Pride of the Clouds. It felt a little bit like one of the benefits of having a lot of tokens is that all your opponent's paths become pretty mediocre. They don't really have any good target. Trying to path a Lingering Souls token is just embarrassing and something that they really saved at the last ditch effort. But Pride of the Clouds, you're like, here you go. I have this awesome card that I'm so proud of, please path it, and they will happily do that. And then Judge's Familiar didn't feel quite that good. Mausoleum Water was actually really good. It did the same thing as Judge's Familiar in terms of being able to stop random spells. Like, for example, one match I won was I used Judge's Familiar to counter a Postmortem Lunge to the turn before I had Lethal, and so my Devoted Druid opponent couldn't kill me. The Wanderer, one time my opponent played Saheeli, upticked, it has 4 loyalty, and then I untapped, played Spectral Procession, made 3 spirit tokens, the Wanderer became a 4-4 and killed their Saheeli. And that actually felt like a pretty good interaction. So I would try to refine the deck to be a little bit more heavy on that card and the token makers, which work well together, and a little bit less on the cards that didn't quite click with the rest of the deck, like the Pride of the Clouds and the Judge's Familiar.
Yeah, just looking at the list, Damon, if you cut the Pride of the Clouds, your only blue card left is the Mausoleum Wanderer. So is it that good that it's worth compromising the mana? Or should we just be abandoning blue?
Yeah, that's a possible consideration. Just make it the classic Orzhov tokens list, which I think has been a steady Tier 2 deck in Modern for a very long time.
Tier 2 is generous.
Yeah, that's loose.
Yeah, Tier 2 plus. Tier non-1. Yeah, that's definitely a possibility. I actually really like the spell quarters in the sideboard. One thing about the new Devoted Druid list is that they all play 4 Giver of Runes, which is a huge pain because if you're only playing 4 removal spells, then a single Giver will actually completely shut down your interaction, unless you can manage to draw multiples. And Spellqueller, actually, even if they have this Giver of Runes out, you can just stop their spells, and they don't have a lot of stack interaction. And so losing that actually would be a little bit unfortunate. And actually, it's also good against control decks. It's good against a lot of decks in the format. But certainly, yeah, having a cleaner mana base would go a long way in this deck.
So big picture questions then about Force of Virtue. So how did it feel to draw the Force without Squadron Hawk? And vice versa, drawing Squadron Hawk without Force. You know, we were treating them as kind of a package, but are they serviceable cards on their own when you draw one but not the other?
I found that Squadron Hawk on its own was usually pretty good. I think that you can get redundant effects that help take advantage of it. Going all the way back to Martyr of Sands, which lets you gain a lot of life with it, to Smuggler's Copter to discard it, to the Seasoned Pyromancer effect, to the Force of Virtue. There's a lot of different ways to take advantage of having extra cards in your hand. The other direction, Force of Virtue without Squadron Hawk, the card was a little bit weird where, yeah, I mean, like, it's a pretty big cost to exile a card. Frequently, Force of Will is considered, like, the worst spell in your deck in fair matchups in Legacy, and Force has the same kind of issue. But still, I mean, Force of Virtue with Spectral Procession is a lot of power on the board, and it's hard to handle that power because it's in the form of three separate flyers. So it wasn't amazing on its own, but it was manageable. And it is legitimately castable. I mean, you do make it to four mana sometimes.
Yeah, that would be my sense as well. I mean, I felt very happy with Squadron Hawk. It does just enough, even without discard outlets, just to kind of annoy Planeswalkers, give you some kind of a board presence. I mean, you can always chump block. But yeah, I mean, Force of Virtue without the sort of free extra cards from Squadron Hawk to turn into the board presence, it is a real cost. I played it, you know, exiling Path or whatever against Control several times. So in that sense, I guess it can take away some of the more polarizing cards in your deck. But I wouldn't want to play four Force of Virtue in a list that did not have four Squadron Hawk. I can't imagine that's ever right in Modern.
Yeah, I agree that they are actually best friends, even if you have to be able to survive with them not being together.
Yeah, I think I was, in the deck that I was playing, I was happier with Force of Virtue than I was with Squadron Hawk. Obviously, they were both great together. And there were some matchups where I sided out the Hawks and not the Force of Virtue. And I know that was maybe a little bit crazy, but it was that phenomenon you were describing, Damon, where, you know, if they play something on two mana, that it's probably going to be bigger than a 1/1 flyer. So every turn that I was casting a Squadron Hawk, I felt like I was, you know, you're falling behind, and, you know, you're kind of playing this weird sort of stutter step strategy where you start off a little bit behind, and then you try to catch up quickly with a free spell, or like suddenly deploying, in my case, suddenly deploying a bunch of tokens, or like a Knight of the White Orchid, or whatever it was. But just like casting Squadron Hawk, you know, game one, unknown opponent, Squadron Hawk, go, you're not feeling great about, you're not in control of the game. You're probably just behind by virtue of having spent two mana on this 1/1 flyer. So yeah, I think it's a question of like converting that to some other resource, whether that's pressure or trading it for other cards or making it a 2/2.
Yeah, I mean, like this list playing Smuggler's Copter is a really good example. You know, if you play Smuggler's Copter on two, Squadron Hawk on three, and you turn the Squadron Hawk into something else, that just feels great. I mean,
I do agree that somehow Squadron Hawk is a very strange card. I still don't have a strong sense of if it's like sneakily good or still just not there. Sometimes it would feel really strong. Sometimes it would feel, yeah, you're playing two mana for a 1/1 flyer. Like Modern is just not about things like even in that stratosphere of power level. But then the times where you would start steadily, you know, accruing Hawks where you could use them to take out Planeswalkers or just steadily, you know, chump blockers or all sorts of things. Like sometimes it does come into play, and it is literally, you know, drawing three cards is one of the most powerful effects in Magic, even if they're all Squadron Hawks.
Yeah, we weren't even playing Misfile Planes. You can keep drawing Squadron Hawks if you want to.
Yeah, that's an interaction that I missed a little bit. I agree, that is actually better than it sounds.
So one thing I noticed was that I was losing a large number of game ones. And I think that's kind of going to just come with this kind of, any build that has these cards in it, like Crusade Effect and a Squadron Hawk, is probably built to play fair Magic that is combat-based and involves paying mana for your creatures. And there's a good swath of the Modern format is just going to beat that in game one. It's going to be doing something a little bit stronger, more broken, that doesn't involve the battlefield in that way. And then it's just like, okay, 10 cards come in from the sideboard, and it's like, all right, I'm mad now. You crushed me with something unfair in game one, so here come all these sideboard cards. And then it's sort of not really clear like what role the Squadron Hawk played necessarily. You're just trying to like get them with strong interaction in game two. And that's kind of just where white lives in Modern, I think. I don't necessarily think that's a specific problem to this deck, although it's very pronounced here. But like white tends to not have broken things to do. So it always tends to be this way.
I think you're just describing fair Magic, period, in Modern. It's not a good game one deck.
It's true that white does have some of the better sideboard cards out there, though.
Yes.
When you build a white deck and build it in a, like, once you can adapt to their game plan and have the right cards in your 60, white decks can actually be pretty effective.
So there's some hope. So any final thoughts then on Force of Virtue?
Yeah, I agree that I think that the Elesh Norn Nykthos deck felt like the best of the ones we tried overall. It somehow felt like that leveraged the pips and the card in a way that their decks just only leveraged the card itself, like the pump effect. That deck when I was watching, you didn't seem quite there, but it looks like the changes you made, they made a lot of sense to me.
Back to sort of my original proposed build that I was told to alter, so.
That's how we do it. That's what we're all about.
I do think that the seasoned pyromancer list is probably better without Force of Virtue specifically, and whether it's good at all with Squadron Hawk really remains to be seen. So I think if you're going to play the sort of two cards together, I do think that Damon's correct. They're sort of just the fundamental weakness of the individual cards in the sort of tokens list really put you at a disadvantage, where at least in the mono white list, you do get to play cards that can sort of are one card wins, assuming you can cast them.
Would you want the Misfail Plains in the Mardu build?
No.
But you can actually get the Hawks in the graveyard.
Yeah, that, I mean, you're already playing this really slow game where you're casting a 2-mana 1/1, and then you're like, oh, I should make my mana even worse and have one more land come into play tapped. In case all the value I get from that isn't enough, I want like another card on turn, you know, whatever, 6 or 7. I think that's asking for too much. If Squadron Hawk is already what we're considering maybe to be questionable power level, an extra Squadron Hawk to make your mana worse is another problem altogether. Also, if you're Marduing or Pyromancering your Squadron Hawks to the graveyard, you actually don't end up with 2 white permanents in play very often at all. Like, the best use of the Squadron Hawk is to get turned into 2 1/1 red elementals for free, for no mana.
The Hawks want to fly free, and all you want to do is grind them into elementals. Exactly.
I want to throw them into the graveyard where they cry out for justice. So yeah, I think that's a pretty good overview of Force of Virtue. I mean, did Tom Ross break Modern when he designed this card? Yeah, it seems like he did. Is it going to survive the banned and restricted announcement? It's unclear at this point. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we are going to discuss some new brews featuring an M20 card for next week.
Okay, welcome back. So we have some new brews for this week featuring Core Set 2020, which somehow is already out. Not only is a full spoiler out, but you can actually play with the set online as of today. So there's a few new cards that we think are intriguing for Modern. The one that we're going to talk about this week is the card Lotus Field. It is a land. It has hexproof. It enters the battlefield tapped, and when Lotus Field enters the battlefield, sacrifice 2 lands. So that's a pretty hefty cost. The trade-off, it has the ability tap, add 3 mana of any one color. So it taps for a black Lotus. All you have to do is sacrifice 2 lands. So what are our thoughts on this card? What do we like about it? What is the upside here?
Yeah, well, first off, I like the design of the card. There's a card, Lotus Veil, that this card basically replaces that is very, very similar but without hexproof. And that card was always just too much of a risk for the reward in a world with Field of Runes or Wastelands or whatever, and depending on the format. The key question for this card, though, is you really don't go up a card at all in the sense that you give up 2 lands to plus this land to get 3 mana, so that's 3 land drops and 3 lands for 3 mana, which isn't fundamentally breaking the rules of the game at all. So the question is, how can you use the fact that it comes from one source to really do well? And so the first thing that I thought of when I saw this card was Blood Sun is a card that has seen some fringe play in a few different formats that would get rid of your sack 2 land clause, and now you have one land that just provides 3 mana, which does break the rules of the game. You lose the hexproof, but hopefully, you know, your opponent's Field of Runes also lose their ability.
Damon, can you just tell everybody what Blood Sun does, just so they know?
Yes, so Blood Sun is a really strange card that's, it's kind of like a Blood Moon, but it's a sun, and so it's 2 and a red for an enchantment, and it has a cantrip clause, which is very interesting for a Blood Moon type effect, very strange. And it says that all lands lose non-mana activated abilities. And so this has seen some play in Legacy because it turns off the disadvantages from your City of Traders. You can just keep playing extra lands. And meanwhile, it completely blanks fetch lands. Blood Moon doesn't invalidate fetch lands completely. They can still tap for a red mana. Even if you're not a red deck, that's still useful. But Blood Sun makes them just literally sit there and do nothing, which is actually a pretty powerful effect if you can use that asymmetrically.
So Blood Sun is one of those cards that saw a lot of initial hype when it was previewed in Rivals of Ixalan because of the ability to turn off fetch lands. It didn't catch on in Modern, and I'm thinking that, you know, I was surprised to hear you say that it sees play in Legacy. In Modern, I think the reason that it didn't really catch on is that it doesn't disrupt enough lands. Like, it can disrupt any future fetch land drawn from turn 3 or 4 onward, that's not really enough. You know, the lands that people are afraid of, like Tron lands, are not affected by this. So I guess you kind of answered my question that, like, the decks that were able to leverage it well are the decks that actually proactively benefit from it by playing lands that have drawbacks, and then the drawback disappears under the Blood Sun. So City of Traders, Lotus Field, they both fit that mold. Would you say that's the case?
Yeah, I mean, certainly Blood Sun isn't like a major card in Legacy, but yeah, the reason it was useful was because you get the benefit from hurting your opponent and a slight benefit to your own lands. And Lotus Field with no drawback is like an insane card. One land for 3 mana is just insane. It actually makes it feel much more like an actual like Lotus card. It even loses the ETB tapped clause.
Yeah, that's big game.
But yeah, I have a shell that we'll discuss later where the ideal start involves a turn 2 or turn 3 Blood Sun, and then a turn 4 Lotus Field will take you from 3 mana to 6 mana, and there's a lot of cool spells at 6 mana in Magic. But yeah, I think you guys have a couple other ideas for how to kind of abuse Lotus Field and make it go from a pretty fair card into an unfair card.
Well, Dave, do you have any more you want to add to the like the general overview of this card?
I think that what Damon is outlining is kind of the only way I would think to sort of break this card. I think they did a pretty good job designing it to try to minimize sort of the unfair ways you'd want to play it, other than using something like a Kiora, which we have at various points proposed in lists, so that makes Kiora's +1 tap for 3, which is quite powerful. There are other cards that untap lands, Garruk being one of them.
Twiddle being the other.
Twiddle.
I mean, what's interesting is that this card has Hexproof, not Shroud, possibly just because of the new design philosophy that Shroud makes people confused. But this means that you can target your Lotus Field with Twiddle effects, which turns Twiddle into a Dark Ritual. And in theory, you can build a deck that, I mean, Dark Ritual is a very, very powerful Magic card. And so I think we all kind of have the question, like, is there some sort of Twiddle Storm type deck that can use this card?
You can build your own Seething Song, to use the modern equivalent of Dark Ritual. One of the first cards banned from Storm. Actually, well, that's not even true. The third card banned from Storm, let's say, in the long history of Storm bannings. So, yeah, there's all these clauses on the card, and each one offers different possibilities for getting around it. Sacrificing 2 land. You're talking about Blood Sun as a way to just erase that clause. Another way you could do it is either just play a deck based on land recursion. So, yes, you do sacrifice 2 lands, but you're not actually down cards at that point. You've traded, as Damon was saying, 3 land drops, and you have a land now that makes 3 mana, so you're not actually behind, you just have 2 lands in the graveyard. So if you have a deck that is built on recurring those lands, that maybe wants to put lands in the graveyard, or that has something like, maybe even like a Flagstones of Trocare, where sacrificing a land is not so bad, you can get ahead that way. And even the Enter the Battlefield Tapped clause, you know, Blood Sun erases that, Amulet of Vigor is another way to get around that, where you can jump the curve on mana if you can get around that clause. All those possible synergies aside, this card is not actually card disadvantage. It is a totally acceptable, fair card if you're willing to play a tap land on turn 3. The lands you sacrifice, you can tap them for mana first before you sacrifice them. It's not as bad as Lotus Veil was, where you had to actually sacrifice untapped lands.
I think it's worth noting for the Amulet clause that you can stack your triggers such that you get the 3 mana before you have to sacrifice your 2 lands. So that is a large mana bump for at turn. With Amulet in play.
Correct. Yeah. So I think from this initial discussion, we've kind of hinted at a few different directions we would like to explore with the deck. So to kick it off, should we talk first about the Knight of the Reliquary build?
Sure. So there used to be a deck called, I think it was just Green-White Value Town, yes? You played this list at a couple tournaments.
That's the name that it is usually known by,
sure.
Green White Value Town.
Todd Stevens, who, whatever, we won't go into the details, but he is a streamer. He had some success with it at various Star City games, and I know Nassif had played it quite a bit on his stream as well. So this was a different modern time, so no one's saying that that deck is playable now. You don't see the Reliquary is hilariously poorly positioned against many of the popular decks. But a new card... in addition to Lotus Field, which has a similar effect to Knight of the Reliquary, is a card called Elvish Reclaimer. So it's 1 green for an Elf Warrior. It's 1/2. As long as there are 3 or more land cards in your graveyard, it gets +2/+2. and it has the ability to 2-mana, sacrifice a land, colon, search your library for a land card, put it into the battlefield tapped, then shuffle your library. So that's somewhat different than Knight of the Reliquary in multiple ways. One, it can sacrifice any land. And two, it can search your library for any land card, but it puts it into play tapped. So the list I'm proposing has four of those, four Birds of Paradise, four Sakura Tribe Scout is sort of your, eight of them are ramp effects, the Reclaimer, sort of your value card. It does play four Knight, four Courser of Kruphix. And then basically it just tries to use the fact that you're going to be putting all kinds of lands in your graveyard. So it has Ramunap Excavator, it has Life from the Loam, it has Renin 6, which is the new Planeswalker for Modern Horizons. And then in addition to sort of your normal green-white lands, it has just a few value lands. One of them is Flagstones of Trocaire. One of them is Bajuka Bog. So one of the powerful abilities that Elvish Reclaimer has is that if you play it on turn one, you can actually get a Bajuka Bog and play on turn two, which is something that Knight of the Reliquary never could do. And obviously one Bajuka Bog doesn't win you the game, but with the ability throughout the course of the to use Elvish Reclaimer next turn to sacrifice Bajuka Bog, and then you could play it again from your graveyard through a variety of other ways. It does give you some main deck outs to some of the graveyard decks. And one of the value lands I have in this shell is a Lotus Field. So you can get a Lotus Field to sacrifice lands you'd want to put in your graveyard to replay again, like Bajuka Bog. There's a Flagstones of Trocaire as well that allows you to fetch up Lotus Field as like a super ramp card. And then putting lands in your graveyard is useful when you have Life from the Loam, Renin 6, and Ramunap Excavator.
Yeah, this list looks really interesting. I mean, the turn one Elvish Reclaimer into turn two Bajuka Bog, I feel like that can win you a lot of matches in Modern, or at least a lot of game ones. That is actually a pretty big speed bump to a lot of these decks.
I think that's a losing line, personally. I don't think that's realistic. You can do that against Hogak. Well, because you're nowhere at that point. You've spent 3 mana. All you have on the board is a 1/2 and a land and a Bajuka Bog. Like, what deck is stopped by that?
Presumably they invested resources to get cards into their graveyard that you exiled. Like, you don't do this when they play, you know, turn one, fetch land, go. Hey, Bajuka Bog, this is after they've hit, like, a Bridge from Below or just, like, you know, got, like, a Vengevine into the graveyard. Like, they will burn resources filling up their graveyard. And certainly, yeah, Hogak, one of the reasons it's so good is that it's resilient and it can just sort of rebuild very quickly. But still, every bit does get you closer.
Well, okay, I'm not saying that's a bad card to have access to. I just don't want to oversell this and make it sound like that's actually going to move the needle against the dedicated graveyard decks. It was more true against Dredge, where they would keep a hand based on being able to dredge once. And Hogak is not like that. Hogak can just refill a limited number of times.
Sure. I would say that I think it does move the needle. It doesn't make it effortless. I think it will give you a boost in that matchup.
Yeah, I mean, you're basically, all these spare decks are at 0%, so you go from that to a non-zero number, and it is probably still very low, but, you know, it is what it is.
True.
Yeah. In my experience, is that basically, against graveyard decks, what you want is to have a speed bump card and then a closer card. So, for example, maybe your speed bump is Surgical, and your closer is Rest in Peace, or Containment Priest, for example, depending on the format, or Leyline of the Void is kind of like a one card that fits both roles. This comes on turn zero. And this deck basically has the Elvish Reclaimer into Bajuka Bog as your speed bump, and then Scavenging Ooze as your closer. And so I think that having the two in conjunction will actually be potentially quite strong in those matchups.
Yeah, I mean, that's the hope. I guess we'd have to actually play the games to see how it would play out. I don't even have a sideboard here proposed, but obviously, as we talked about, when you're playing white, you have access to a lot of powerful cards. I think another one of the weaknesses of this particular deck is it is quite reliant on the graveyard itself, although not totally. So it does make your deck somewhat susceptible to graveyard hate.
Which cards are reliant on the graveyard?
Knight of the Reliquary, Ramunap Excavator, Elvish Reclaimer, Life from the Loam, Renin 6.
So the recursion elements, and then yes, making your Elvish Reclaimer and Knight into big beaters.
Yes.
But yeah, my question for this list is, you have this like Sakura Tribe Scout Azusa plan, but you don't really have any big mana plays to make. And so I'm really just not sure, like Sakura Tribe Scout, fundamentally, if you compare it to Llanowar Elves, like 1/1 is just like, it looks terrible in comparison. It does ramp you, but it requires you to burn land drops or burn land cards in the process. And so you're kind of down a card once you cast it. And the reason why it's good in Amulet Titan is that the lands you're playing are these bounce lands, which fundamentally have you go up a card. And so it really nicely interacts with those. And you don't have those here. And so I wonder if Sakura Tribe Scout is just like belongs in the Shell along with Azusa.
Well, the thought is against decks where the graveyard thing doesn't matter, you just start ghost quartering them over and over again. I mean, that's the goal.
That's like a Ramunap Excavator type line, not a Sakura Tribe Scout line. Maybe Azusa is involved in that. It helps you accelerate that process. But against Tron, for example, like I feel like one ghost quarter return is actually pretty good. You don't really need the Azusa to really close it that fast. You can.
Well, there's no Tron to beat. So, I mean, this is against like a Pharaoh yeah. deck that has four or five basics, and we're just going to try to run them out of there. So with Life from the Loam and Ren and six, we can start playing multiple ghost quarters a turn if we don't have our Azusa.
This is a card that I have struggled with myself as I've been thinking about various builds, both with Lotus Field and with Ren and six and just general ramp shells. So what do you need to make Sakura Tribe Scout not suck? And I think the only successful deck that's used it so far is Amulet Titan, as Damon was saying. And I wonder if that's because of the bounce lands in particular make it so that you always have lands in your hand. And I think that makes me think that any deck like this, well, this is a 23 land deck that you've sketched out. I think Sakura Tribe Scout is just off the table. You're not going to have lands in your hand. And the extra land play cards that you have in here, like Ramunap Excavator, Corsair Crucifix, those are proven cards. They actually don't work with Sakura Tribe Scout in any way. They kind of look like they do, but they don't. Because the Sakura Tribe requires you to have a natural land in hand. And only Life from the Loam and Ren and 6 do that here. So I do like those synergies, but like we're not all in on them. And I'm kind of wondering if that's just like a little bit unfocused. Like we should pick one. Either pick the graveyard or pick lands in hand.
Yeah, maybe Course of Crucifix doesn't really do either. And maybe that card just doesn't belong in this list.
So I mean, just to clarify, I do really like Sakura Tribe Scout with Ren and 6 and Life from the Loam. So I'd be willing to go like up to more copies of one or the other. Actually, I think one of the decks that I want to discuss has Scout and more copies of Ren and 6 and Life from the Loam. But in this deck, I think that you get more out of like a Noble Hierarch than you would out of a Sakura Tribe Scout just because of the low land count.
Yeah, I mean, I think honestly, like, what's our like overall, you know, 2 sentence description of what is this deck trying to do? Is it basically just like a lands type deck where the goal is to use your lands to develop an advantage and just abuse that with the land recursion plus the land ramp and multiple land drops a turn type cards?
Yes, that's correct.
Because yeah, like a type of deck that Modern really just hasn't seen at all. I mean, Amulet Titan is kind of doing that, but I really don't think of that deck that way.
The green-white value town that Dave was describing was a moderately successful deck for a year and a half. You know, it feels like ages ago, but it had good matchups. I think one of the key differences between that deck and this one is that that was a collected company deck where I think it was saying, you know, the core engine pieces are these three mana creatures like Knight of the Reliquary, Courser, Excavator, Azusa. They all cost three. I want mana dorks to accelerate them out on turn two, and then I want Collected Company to get more of them more quickly. And here, I think it's that focus question of like instead of having Collected Company, we have, you know, two Life from the Loam, two Ren and six. So I think we just should just choose one, if that makes sense.
Well, I feel like the value town decks you're describing are much more kind of creature based, like value creatures, and this is much more about the land recursion.
I mean, they are and they aren't. So it really depends on the matchup. Like we were saying in our field of virtue testing, there's a huge chunk of the modern format that just doesn't care about how good your creatures are. And in those matchups, you need some other way to just like needle them to interact with them. And the Ghost Quarter land package can do that in a way that just like having creatures can't do. So it's kind of like a versatile strategy. It can attack on different axes. It actually doesn't fold the Tron, which no other green-white deck in history has ever been able to say, right? So there's definitely something here that's like actually kind of good in the right metagame. We may be returning to a Tron metagame with a Linda Mugglin. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, I actually really am interested in this idea of the kind of green-white land recursion. I actually play the deck Maverick, green-white Maverick in Legacy. I made a top four of a 1K this weekend with it. So Knight of the Reliquary, even though it has fallen on hard times in Modern, is actually still quite strong in Legacy because of the card Wasteland. And somehow Ghost Quarter plus Azusa plus Ramunap Excavator actually feels kind of like Wasteland at some point. And so that's why this deck, I don't know. I think that there's some promise here. I'm not sure about the Nantuko Cultivator or Ayula's influence, but I definitely am curious to see how this deck performs.
You said Green-White Maverick, Damon?
Yeah.
So refresh our memories. What is Green-White Maverick?
Yeah, so basically it actually looks fairly similar to this list. It has a lot of cards in common. It runs a 4 of Noble Hierarch and a 4 of Knight of the Reliquary. It also runs 4 Thalias. And then it runs a Green Sun Zenith package, which is just more efficient than whatever Modern has available, with Finale of Devastation being the closest thing. And so this lets you get your plan online just like a little bit faster, because your 4 Green Sun Zenith actually give you like a lot of 1-drop mana dorks, because between 4 literal 1-drop mana dorks and 4 GSCs, you now have access to 9 mana dorks. And the reason why GSC is so amazing is that late game, your GSC is not a Dryad Arbor. It fetches you whatever you want, from Knight of the Reliquary to Tireless Tracker to one of my favorite Magic cards ever, Titania, Priestess of Argoth, which is an EDH powerhouse, which is a 5-mana 5/3 that brings a land from your graveyard to the battlefield on ETB, and then whenever a land that you control goes to the graveyard, you make a 5/3 elemental. And so you cast that, you bring back a Wasteland or a Fetchland, and then you get a 5/3 elemental. And if you just have a Knight of the Reliquary out, you then use Knight, you sack a land, you get a fetch land, you use the fetch land, you actually get 2 more elementals, and the game's over. So it's a pretty fun deck. It has actually some pretty good game against combo because of the Hate Bear package with the Thalias and some Gaddock Teagues. And due to GSC, it can actually reliably find those cards. So it's a cool deck if any of you guys really like green-white and are interested in Legacy. And Savannah is one of the cheapest dual lands, and so it's actually a pretty reasonable deck to build.
And you said you actually made top 8 with this weekend at a 1K in Legacy. So it's not just like a, I mean, this sounds like a kitchen table kind of fun favorite card strategy, but it's actually competitive.
Yeah, it's actually quite powerful. It's seeing a bit of a resurgence right now. It's been doing really well in the new Narset meta, because the deck just really doesn't care about Narset or some of the other newer changes to Legacy. It has a pretty good chance against Dreadhorde Arcanist, because you can just block it with Knight of the Reliquary. And frequently, actually, honestly, like, you know, one of the, in the top 8 in the quarterfinals, I played against Grixis Control, which is a bad matchup. But game 1, I had a Thalia and a Knight, and I just wound up wastelanding him 4 times, and his draw was a little bit land light, and it turns out that they can't do a whole lot. And then game 2, I just got to play a lot of really, honestly, it was a really fun game of Magic. We both played a lot of Haymakers, but my Haymakers involved Titania and a Choke. That's not really that's not a fun card, I guess, but it is an effective card. And then like Trackers and Knights, and I don't remember really his name, but the 3 and a green for a Garruk that comes in and deals damage to a creature. That guy eats Baleful Strixes or Ice Bank Coatles for breakfast. We had a really interesting game. So yeah, it's actually a strong deck. I mean, it's a lot of fun. So it also plays a Stoneforge Mystic package, too good for Modern along with GSC. But maybe someday we'll have Stoneforge Mystic in Modern. It wouldn't surprise me. It feels like it belongs, honestly.
They've really had a lot of opportunities to unban it as they've made Modern, you know, faster and faster, and they've been very resistant to it. So I'm not sure what new information they would have that would cause them to unban it, but I wouldn't mind them at least trying it out.
Stoneforge Mystic almost never kills before turn 4, left to its own devices. There is one weird deck that involves, it's called like Cephalid Breakfast, that's like an infinite combo where you use Stoneforge Mystic to find like Shuko and target your do infinite times, mill your entire deck, and then do something involving Dread Returner. I forget the exact payoff. But besides that interaction, which I think that's not a very good deck, the card is very fair.
Well, now you can get the Colossus Hammer, so it's sure to be broken and Modern. So, Dave, would you say that this concept of value time is basically built on the same principles as a Legacy equivalent? Damon was talking about Wasteland. Here we have Ghost Quarter. A worse card, but it does the same thing, more or less.
Yeah, I think the reason that I was sort of attracted to it is you have this Bajuka Bog out that gives you some amount of time to delay them, and then you can maybe luck into sort of just blowing up a bunch of lands. You know, what we found is that Knight of the Reliquary, just doing like value things, is not a Modern playable concept. So you need to do something that's a lot more proactive. So one of the things you could do is to blow up a bunch of their lands and hopefully prevent them from actually playing the game of Magic.
Yeah, I mean, somehow, like, it's true that Azusa plus Ramunap plus Ghost Quarter really is, it's not an infinite combo like Devoted Druid, but it really does close the game out very rapidly.
So I think that I would like to see more ways to find those important pieces. And I think Collected Company actually makes a lot of sense for this shell. If we don't like that, then at least play creature tutors so that we have some equivalent to the Green Sun Zenith that Damon was talking about, in order to like establish these sort of strong board states where you can actually make multiple land drops out of the graveyard in a turn or something like that. The green and white creatures, we've danced the dance with them before, and they're on hard times right now, but maybe they'll have a comeback.
Yeah, I agree with Dan. I think what I'd like to see on this list is maybe cut a couple of the one-ofs, and then try to go a little bit bigger so that you have some payoff. Because it's true that you can use like Azusa and Ramunap to like abuse Ghost Quarter, but also I think these cards will just frequently get you a lot of mana, and having something better to do with a lot of the mana, I think would be really interesting. And maybe that involves like having a little bit more of a toolbox approach, using Finale of Devastation or Eldamri's Call plus, you know, maybe one big mana card. I'm not sure if that's like a, you know, like a, is it a Sun Titan or is it a Primeval Titan? Like, I'm not really sure. Or maybe you just, you know, don't go the tutor package, but you just go a few more big mana cards.
So I need to ask the hard questions now, Dave. So is this a field? Oh, is this a Lotus Field deck?
Or is this what? that wasn't a question.
is this a Lotus Field deck?
It's a deck that has Lotus Field in it.
Or what role does Lotus Field play?
It destroys lands that we want to replay from the graveyard, specifically Bajuka Bog, and it also ramps us if we have Flagstones or Shoal Care in play.
That's an interesting synergy. I didn't even think about that. So, yeah, Bojuka Bog is a one-shot unless you can somehow replay it. So you're actually getting proactive use out of the Sacrifice Two Lands ability.
Not that you always have time to do this, but you can play Elvish Reclaimer. On turn two, you fetch up, you sack a land to fetch up your Flagstones. And on the next turn, you sack Flagstones to get your Lotus Field. So it's a ton of mana, but you can slowly process your way to a ramp state there.
Yeah, I mean, what I find interesting is that Lotus Field, you can really just think of it as being a ETB land. Like, if you play on turn three, if you're using your two lands, that really is all it does. And so it's sort of like fail state where you have nothing good to do with its effects or anything. It's not that bad. On the other hand, I mean, the Ghost Quarter package, actually, you can use Ghost Quarter to kill your own Bajuka Bog, which actually, you know, isn't half bad if you have a Ramnuk Excavator ready to recur it. And so I kind of agree that maybe Lotus Field is interesting. Like, if you want to recur lands, you can also just use fetch lands. That's like the classic use case.
I don't want to abandon Lotus Field. I actually think we should just go harder on the synergies that Dave was just pointing out. So I was thinking that, you know, this deck would be perfect for like a full playset of Flagstones and a full playset of Ghost Quarter in conjunction with maybe multiple Lotus Fields and the card Brought Back, which we talked about last week. That's a new one, again, from M20. White instant, return two, or up to two, permanents from your graveyard to the battlefield that were put there this turn. And I have been thinking that, like, Ghost Quarter and Flagstones is probably the best way to actually get two lands off of the Brought Back. Because I think, Dave, you were correctly pointing out that just having two uncracked fetches is highly unlikely. But Lotus Field is also kind of tailor-made for that as well. Any two lands that you have, it doesn't matter what they are, you can float two mana, you can float white-white off them, and play the Lotus Field, sack those lands, and then play Brought Back to get the lands, and now you've got, like, you're up to five mana suddenly.
Dan, I kind of feel like that just might be a different deck overall. I feel like if you're going to play four Flagstones, your mana base starts to skew really heavily white.
Yes.
You need a lot of planes to fetch. And I like the idea a lot. Also, Brought Back requires double white. That feels maybe more like a mono-white ramp, like Sun Titan type of deck, more than like a green-white toolbox deck.
Yeah, Sun Titan was the exact card I was thinking of, Damon, when he started going through sort of the lines he was outlining. You could play Knight of Reliquary in that list and have tons of planes for the Knight of Reliquary to sacrifice, but maybe it would be like one of the few green cards if you wanted to play green at all.
Yeah, and certainly if you're going to play four Flagstones of Trocare, then Ayula's Influence has to go, which I don't know if that's acceptable or not.
Well, the Lotus Field can cast it, so...
Yeah,
that's true, that's true.
But no, I understand that this will be a different shell will require a white heavy base. But as I'm looking at this list, I'm thinking, well, that's the synergy that I'm most excited about, I think, is Flagstones, Ghost Quarter, Lotus Fields, possibly Brought Back, possibly Elvish Reclaimer to you know, just like the flag zones, like you were saying, or Final Lotus Field, it would look different, right? It would not necessarily even be like a green deck anymore, but I think it would make sense to play some green cards in there. The Flagstones mana base is capable of splashing. You just don't see it very often. And the Flagstones can find any planes. It can find Temple Garden if it needs to.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, Dana, it looks like you didn't bring... None of us brought this sort of much heavier white brought back Lotus Veil deck, Lotus Field deck to the table, but we should try that sometime. I like the sound of that. It sounds for sure promising and intriguing.
Yeah, I've been playing a lot of white decks this week, so I give it a short break. But
people all have the blue decks figured out. you just play Narset, Teferi, etc. There's nothing fun to do with blue these days. I mean, maybe Twiddlestorm is where it's at for fun blue innovations.
I'm interested to hear more about Blood Sun. Was there more you want to say about this Naya build, or should we take a quick look at the other sketches?
Let's take a look at the Blood Sun list.
Yeah, so this list starts off with the following idea, 4 Lotus Field and 4 Blood Sun. As we mentioned before, the point of Blood Sun is that it randomly hoses opponent's fetch lands and also makes your Lotus Field not require you sacrifice 2 lands. And that's big game. Lotus Field becomes like a ridiculous card then. It's just like, imagine there's a land that was, this land taps for 3 mana. That's insane. And Blood Sun is like a passable card. It cantrips. And so the question is what to do from there. And I'm not really sure, to be honest. I think that's like an interesting starting, you know, 8 cards. But the rest is like, you know, I don't really know. The legacy list involving Blood Sun uses Punishing Fire, which is not a modern card. And so the directions I thought of were, first off, kind of more like a Tron-style list. And then secondly, more of like an Eldrazi-style list. And then third, more of a mono-red prison type of list. And I think what I built was... a list that is not Tron for sure, but is a mix of the Mono Red Prison and Eldrazi. And so the point is that you can use a Lotus Field to ramp out the bigger Eldrazi, or some bigger mana cards that a Prison deck typically can't afford to play. Like Prison decks just don't get to 6 mana, but with Lotus Field you can, and so that gives you room to play some like Inferno Titans or Ugins. And so... what this deck has is it has, first off, 4 Chalice of the Void. That card seems to be pretty well positioned. It's pretty good against Hogak and Phoenix. It's not bad against Blue-White. And so it's good against a lot of the top modern decks. And then it features 4 Simeon Spirit Guides to either get you your Chalice out early or actually your Blood Sun ahead of schedule. And early Blood Sun really actually does, you know, every fetch on your opponent's hand just basically just loses everything. It just becomes nothing. And it actually feels pretty bad to kill a Blood Sun. If they're like, oh man, I have all these fetch lands, I need to get rid of the Blood Sun somehow. But it cantripped. It just feels bad to do that. I've been on that side of the table before. It doesn't feel good. And so somehow, actually, if you use a Spirit Guide to ramp out a Blood Sun, it really isn't actually, I think, as weak as it sounds. And if your follow-up plays a Lotus Field, I think even though you're down a card in the Spirit Guide, you're up a lot of kind of virtual cards with the Lotus Field and the Blood Sun cantrip. The deck from there tries to play some bigger mana cards like Thought Knot Seers, Reality Smashers, a couple Endbringers, Inferno Titans, and some Ugins. And then there's a couple Anger of the Gods, and then 3 Mindstone to help round out the ramp package in case your Lotus Field plan isn't working. A couple Walking Ballista just to kind of be the glue that holds a lot of decks together. One decision I had to make was whether Expedition Map is important here to help reliably find Lotus Field, or you know, you just naturally draw into it being good enough. So... that's the list. What do you guys think?
I actually think this deck is actually quite interesting. You still have your openings where you can Spirit Guide plus Eldrazi Temple and play a turn 3 Thought Knot Seer or turn 2 Thought Knot Seer, which is disruptive. Yeah, I do think the Chalice of the Void for 1 is very good. I don't think Ugin the Ineffable is very good right now, but I think the rest of the package is very intriguing. So maybe if we moved Ugin to like a one of and played like the 4th Inferno Titan and the 4th Reality Smasher and maybe like a 4 mana Chandra that also is sort of a pseudo ramp card to 6. I mean, I get a little worried that there isn't that much interaction with like cheap creatures, but I think Anger of Gods does a good job kind of cleaning it up. So yeah, I think this list is super interesting.
Yeah, I agree that like it's not clear that like Reality Smasher, it's a powerful card, but does it really belong here? Should we be using our card slots more? On like, I agree that Chandra will be good here. Maybe the 4th Inferno Titan or the 3rd Anger of the Gods. And yeah, I'm not also sure that Ugin is good. I mean, you do kind of, like, is Ugin the best 6 mana play? Like, maybe it should just be Wurmcoil Engine.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of like what plays from other decks. Okay, they're, you know, we're smart. We were playing six mana card on four. What's the four drop they play that like Ugin feels really good against? And I'm not 100% sure what it is. Obviously, it's not great against control unless they have a Planeswalker in play, then it's awesome. So that's the one time when it's great, right? But most of the time, Infernal Titan's going to do the same thing. And we can make Infernal Titan uncomfortable with our Cavern should we draw it. Then it also leaves this, you know, very quickly game-ending card in play.
Yeah, I mean, actually, I think Ugin is good. If it resolves, is actually quite strong against control.
Yes, no, I agree. I think that's the best matchup, if it resolves.
Yeah, now that I think about it, I think, honestly, yeah, like I think a Wyrmcoil Engine-type package might be a little bit better at the six-mana slot.
I just learned a moment ago that Ugin the Ineffable reduces the cost of colorless spells you cast by two.
Yep.
Did you know that? I had no idea.
Are you joking or yep. What?
Well, I mean, like, I've never seen this card in play outside of Limited, where, you know, at that point.
I haven't played against you all the time. I
your vision is
Eldrazi Tron plays like a one or two of or some Tronless. I've had it played against me several times.
The format's so big. I mean, like, I know those decks exist. I just haven't faced one recently.
Just try to cast a Chalice for one with the Trinisir and Ugin out on MTGO. And things get weird. I think it works, but you'll learn that Ugin does some weird stuff.
So something else that clicked for me, having a slow evening here, was that, like, oh, Eldrazi and Red Prison. Like, why don't we see that more often? Like, you could lock them out with a Blood Moon and then get him. Like, oh, that's right, because Eldrazi cannot coexist with Blood Moon, because Blood Moon turns off all your colorless sources. So you have Blood Sun, where I might expect Blood Moon in a deck as like the disruptive enchantment that screws their lands. We're saying Blood Sun will actually actively help us with the Lotus Field. And then if it happens to screw with their fetch lands, that's also good.
Yeah, this deck doesn't quite have the hard lock of the Blood Moon. That's why I like being very proactive with our creature base and saying, all right, Blood Sun's delaying them a turn, maybe, or whatever. They get one fetch land that never gets to be cracked. But in the meantime, we're beating the shit out of them with, you know, Infernal Titans or Death Touch artifacts.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't the type of deck that thinks it can win with a single Rabble Master behind its, you know, Chalices and Trinispheres and Blood Moons. This is a deck that needs some bigger game and brings the bigger game. And yeah, the Legacy Blood Sun decks were Eldrazi decks, and they used Eldrazi plus Punishing Fire for early interaction. For the exact reason you mentioned that, yeah, Blood Moon actively messes up your Eldrazi plan, but Blood Sun happily coexists with it.
It's a really weird card. There's all these weird rulings with it. Like, it doesn't turn off Grove of the Burn Willows, which is that Punishing Fire interaction, because that's still a mana ability. They gain life as part of the mana ability. You have a Cavern of Souls in here. If you play the Cavern after the Blood Sun, you don't get to name a creature type, but any already played caverns retain their functionality, so don't expect this to shut down humans entirely. Any caverns or unclaimed territories they've already played still get to tap for mana, but future caverns will not. Weird little card.
Yeah, it is. Honestly, like, I feel like the more we play with it, we'll probably keep learning strange things it does.
And in the Lotus Field mirror, it, of course, sets us at a serious disadvantage.
Yeah.
So I kind of like the look of this. I'm intrigued. Do you think that Blood Sun is worth enough to try something like Desperate Ritual to get it out on turn two? Like, you have the Spirit Guides, but you have Mind Stone instead as like an actual mana source.
Yeah, my concern is just that the deck really wants to try to get to six mana for the big guys. And that's the whole point of playing this Lotus Field after you play the Blood Sun. If you play Blood Sun and get a Lotus Field in play, and you're like, haha, I didn't sack two lands, I have all this mana, but you don't have any big payoffs, it doesn't really do a whole lot for you. And so the problem is that if you play like these rituals, it becomes really hard to play a lot of big cards. And so that's where I'm actually not sure about, you know, four Simeon Spirit Guides. Like, is that too many? Is that enough? But certainly that is an interesting lever to pull. Like, do we want more ritual effects? And I'm certainly not sure about the direction I chose with four.
I think four is the right number. I think you got it right.
I wonder if this should borrow some technology from the colorless Eldrazi decks, where they use Eternal Scourge, which you can play from exile. They use that in conjunction with Serum Powder and Gemstone Caverns. It happens to be a 3-drop, so the turn you play your untapped Lotus Field, you can just get any Scourges you have already exiled. But if you could find room in the deck for 4 Serum Powder, a few Gemstone Caverns, and 4 Eternal Scourges, one of your Eldrazi's, you know, it still works with the Eldrazi Temple, I wonder if that might give you more redundancy at the sort of key spots on the mana curve, like the, you know, the turn you could in theory play a Blood Sun immediately followed up with a Lotus Field with only 3 mana to make that turn. So like the Scourge is something you could play there.
Yeah, I think Scourge is just way too weak in the modern, and that's why the Eldrazi list that top 8 did not include those cards. So I'm not sure that's needed at all. I mean, the days of like trying to grind out Jund or whatever, I mean, we got better things to do.
Inferno. Are we already in the London Mulligan days? Like, is it live now?
It's because today,
Core 20's out?
It is, yep.
Ah, okay. Because that's the thing that makes Serum Powder a lot better. So I'm interested. I never, you know, have really actually played a Serum Powder deck, and I don't fully understand exactly what it's supposed to do. I'm certainly open to trying that sort of modification.
It lets you begin the game with the card of your choice, whether that's an Eldrazi Temple, a Chalice on one, or a Leyline.
Can it help you have both a Bloodsun and a Lotus Field? Like, can it help you get kind of like A plus B type things going, or is it more just try to find like one card?
Generally just one card. But, you know, that was before the London Mulligan. With the London Mulligan, I think it's much better than it has ever been. I played a good amount of colorless Eldrazi, and when they announced the London Mulligan as like a test, I just started goldfishing my deck just to see how different it was. And it was pretty remarkable how, like, I always had one of those are the good starts in colorless Eldrazi, or either Chalice on one or Eldrazi Temple. And it seemed like I always had it suddenly, whereas before you had to go down to like 4 or 3 cards sometimes. But finding any specific 2-card combo, that might be too much to ask. He was very good at exiling Eternal Scourges as well with the London Mulligan. But anyway, I think, Dave, you may be right. You know, it is noticeable. I keep expecting to see more Eldrazi Stompy lists doing well, and it's primarily Eldrazi Tron. So.
I like the idea of finding cards. That's very attractive to me. If that's worth it without the maybe only a 1-of, the 3-3 guy, I mean, that card is just very poorly positioned right now, I think. We say maybe the best for last. You have a list.
I have another list that began as a 4-of Lotus Field deck, and by the time I was done with it, I was down to a single Lotus Field as a tutor target. I don't know what that says about the card or the deck. I think one takeaway I had was that there's a lot of land synergy things you could do in Modern, and all these branching decision trees of which ones you want to maximize can just take you in weird places, where this could be a deck that features Lotus Fields. The one that I'm about to describe does not actually feature it, but it just sort of has it as a useful card. So the list that I'm proposing is built around Life from the Loam and Renin 6, both of which get lands out of your graveyard for value. Because of that, I feel like I need a deck that can produce a lot of mana quickly, because it's pretty cool that Renin 6, the +1 ability, essentially draws a card if you're interested in drawing a land. Life from the Loam draws 3 cards, much like a Squadron Hawk. It's almost as good as Squadron Hawk. They're just all lands. But as we learned with Squadron Hawk, that's just really slow. Like, you're moving cards from the graveyard to your hand. That's like the opposite direction of where cards should be going in Modern. You know, to be efficient, they should be going from your hand to the graveyard into the battlefield. So I think that part of the reason that we haven't seen a successful renaissance of like aggro loam or assault loam is that the deck is just like extremely slow, extremely mana intensive, and extremely grindy. So what I wanted to do to address that was play Renin 6, play Life from the Loam in large quantities, but also play like a very high land count and a large number of these cards that make extra land plays. So namely Secure Tribe Scout and even Arboreal Grazer. The Sloth makes an appearance here as a 3-of. I have 4 Secure Tribe Scouts, 3 Arboreal Grazers, 3 Life from the Loam, 4 Renin 6, and 27 lands. From there, I was thinking, like, am I going to flood out? Well, maybe. 27 lands is a lot, but because I'm interested in playing cycling lands, so Tranquil Thicket, Forgotten Cave, and I have a 1-of Sheltered Thicket as well, the Amonkhet green-red cycling land, I don't think I will flood out. I'm hoping I won't. I think that the play pattern I'm envisioning is that you accelerate frequently with these 1-mana green plays that let you make extra land drops, and then you get like a land recursion engine set up. So from there, you actually have to win the game somehow. So I have Seismic Assaults that can do that. I have 3 of them. So you can get a Life in the Loam Seismic Assault engine going. I also have a few alternate routes. So the card that I'm actually playing as a three of here is Awakening of Vitugazi from War of the Spark, a card that I privately compared to Splinter Twin. I think, Dave, I was trying to sell you on this as the green Splinter Twin. So we're going to put that concept to the test here, hopefully. So Awakening of Vitugazi, green, green, three for an instant, says put 9+1/+1 counters on target land you control. It becomes a legendary 0/0 elemental creature with haste named Vitugazi. Still a land. You can put that on any land. If you put that on an Ink Moth Nexus, you suddenly have a 10/10 flying effect. So you can end step Awakening, awaken your Ink Moth, and kill them in one shot. One punch land. You can even do that on your turn if you have enough mana in play. That is a 7-mana play, right? You need 5 for the Awakening. The Ink Moth has to be in play. I need one more to activate the Ink Moth to get up to 10 poison. Apart from that, it's just like a fine card. I'm theorizing. It makes any land into a 9/9. So that's the shell of the deck. The last slots in the deck I gave to some Lightning Bolts as interaction. You want to have something threatening if you ever happen to ultimate Ren and 6. And Lightning Bolt is one of the ones that can clear the board and potentially just deal damage with the retrace ability to win that way. Tarmogoyf is just a guy to hold the ground and distract them from what you're really doing. And the last card that I'm hopeful for is Realms Uncharted, the 3-mana Gifts Ungiven variant. That is an instant that searches your library for 4 land cards with different names, and the opponent puts 2 of them in the grave and 2 go to your hand. From there, I just have a big toolbox of lands, including Lotus Field as a one of, but also things like Ghost Quarter, various man lands, and Blast Zone is in there, and Cycling Lands. All right, that's the concept. What do you guys think?
My first reaction is that your list has not just one, not two, but 3 unique Thicket cards, which I didn't realize that was such a common theme in Magic. The Firelit Thicket, Shelter Thicket, and Tranquil Thicket.
Triple thick.
That's simple.
The list is interesting. I mean, you have 4 Tarmogoyfs in here with like this lands package, and so it's like, is this a like, does Tarmogoyf belong? You have 3 Arboreal Grazers and 4 Sequoia Tribe Scouts, so we really, really want to be playing extra lands a turn. And so I wonder, like, you know, like, yeah, isn't Azusa sort of like a more efficient version of this once you can ramp to 3 mana versus like Arboreal Grazer, which is like maybe like the worst of these cards?
Have you considered at all the one red giant that gets +1/+1 counters when lands go to your graveyard? Countryside Crusher.
I had not considered it, although when I went to look up, you know, existing Assault Loam lists, I found Bronson Magnan's list from the early days of Modern. He won a GP with Aggro Loam, and he had 3 or 4 Countryside Crushers. I think that card is terrible. Do you think it's good?
Not really, but we're playing on one. We're playing a ramp spell, 7. You know, we've got 7 of them, assuming we've got extra lands. And that means that our beater on turn 2 could be that guy instead. And it would be useful to, well, I guess maybe you want the extra lands for the scout.
So Countryside Crusher prevents you from drawing lands ever again. Like, he'll just mill away all the lands on top until you draw a non-land.
Correct. So he helps you find the, you know, 33 cards in your deck. He helps you get to the Arboreal Grazers that are so crucial to what you're trying to do here.
I mean, that's what it's all about, right? It's all about the sloth. So I think that, like, conceptually the difference is that those old-style Loam decks with a Countryside Crusher, like, they are interested in using Life from the Loam to, like, add cards back to their hand, but then they want to convert that card lands in hand into just, like, some other resource. So whether that's through discard, like Raven's Crime is a card you'll often find. Seismic Assault, obviously. Some people list play Flame Jab or Liliana of the Veil. Or, like, they're not doing anything that involves making additional land plays. It's a deck designed to set up a low-resource grind game. And it just so happens that our resources are a bunch of land cards, which we can either play or discard. But it's slow. And I think that today's Modern requires a faster setup. So, like, I want to actually, like, not just draw a bunch of lands, but play extra lands. That's my theory anyway. So that's why I have all these pseudo-exploration cards.
Need a faster setup. Bring in the sloths.
I mean, I guess my concern is this deck doesn't interact. I mean, you're talking about interaction. You've got 3 Lightning Bolts, and I guess Ren and 6 can do a damage to a permanent. I mean, And your clock is, assuming enough ramp, maybe like a turn 5 attack with a V2 Ghazi token if Ink Moth is in play.
Yeah, my interaction is I can deal 1, 2, or 3 damage to various permanents. So take your pick. I got a cone of flame here.
Yeah, this deck is just, it's just very strange. I mean, I don't really even know how to evaluate it. Awakening of Vidu Ghazi.
I've never like played with Realms Uncharted. I feel like that card is like way too big brain for me. Like, I wouldn't even know what to do. Like, I'm not sure what my plan is at the start of the game. So if this deck is good, I'm not gonna say I'd be surprised, but I wouldn't understand why.
Those are all great points, and I have no idea either. I've never seen a deck.
I've never seen Realms Uncharted cast or had even heard it mentioned until you kept saying, you know what card is amazing with Awakening of V2 Ghazi? Like, I would know. And then the answer was Realms Uncharted. And I was just like, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I had to look up both of those cards.
Yeah, that was an actual pre-show conversation that happened several times. Like, hey, Dave, check it out. Realms Uncharted.
Yeah, the only card I really understand this list is the Tarmogoyf. I like understand what Tarmogoyf does. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I would like to see a Bajuka Bog in here. I think that you have some ways to find it, which make that card valuable as a one of main deck inclusion. I do wonder, like, yeah, is Seismic Assault plus Life from the Loam like a modern like way to win a game? Like, can your deck do well against Rest in Pieces or Leyland of the Voids that come out game 2? Why is there a Raging Ravine and a Treetop Village? Like, isn't one just better?
He wants that, like, multiple things to target with Realms Uncharted, I think.
Okay.
Exactly. The beauty, the symmetry of the deck is all coming into focus now. So I suspect that when I actually test this out, I will run into the exact problems that you're describing, where my interaction is just not robust enough. I forgot about Bajuka Bog. I should absolutely put that in. And it's possible that, like, the original Assault Loam strategies, like, had it correct, that hand disruption is the way to, it's not about accelerating yourself, it's about slowing them down, and maybe that's what I should be focusing on. So instead of playing these ramp cards, just, you can just cut the Secure Drive Scouts, cut the Arboreal Grazers, and just put in Thoughtseize instead, Raven's Crime. That might accomplish the same thing of, like, slowing the game down to the point where your recursion engines are relevant. You have to, like, work really hard in Modern to, like, make the game decided by card advantage.
In so much as this deck resembles Legacy Lands, which is like a kind of a red-green deck featuring Life from the Loam and a lot of lands, Exploration is one of the best cards in that deck that really makes it all tick and really converts Life from the Loam into just sort of getting a little bit of value steadily into, like, really letting you take over a game quickly. And so in that sense, like, I guess Sakura Tribe Scout really is a sort of Exploration effect. On the other hand, one of the strengths of Legacy Lands is that it doesn't play any creature's main deck. The only creature we'll ever generate is a 2020 Indestructible Flyer at instant speed. And so you're playing just sort of like the right amount of Lightning Rod creatures where they will all get killed.
I'm in the sweet spot here.
Yeah.
I depend on these exactly enough to be crippled if they are killed.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess, like, you do kind of want your Secure Tribe Scout to eat a path or whatever so that your Ink Moth Nexus Vidu Ghazi plan can go as uncontested.
Yeah, I'm certainly receptive to these weaknesses as things that could just be fatal for the strategy. I do think that Awakening of Vidu Ghazi itself is potentially just like a modern sleeper. I've been interested in the card for a long time. I think actually I was playing Magic Online like a few weeks back, and someone just messaged me and said, like, oh, I've been enjoying the podcast, and by the way, like, Awakening of Vidu Ghazi, that's one you guys should look at. And I was like, yes. Yes, this person gets it. So thank you to whoever that user is for encouraging me to, like, take these crazy ideas on here. Yeah, so, I mean, my thought with that card and, like, why I think it's worth sort of shoehorning into this kind of shell is that if the graveyard is locked down, which I expect to happen frequently in this current meta that we're in, then suddenly, like, the Life from the Loam, the entire concept of, like, life recursion just looks pretty bad. So at that point, what I want is a 9-9 haste or possibly a 10-10 infect flying haste. And Awakening does that while still being sort of on plan when you are running at full speed. Similar for Tarmogoyf. I described it as a distraction, but it's just a flying card.
If the graveyards are removed from the game, then Tarmogoyf, like, you're playing a beater that is weirdly susceptible to the same thing as your, like, engine piece. So that's my concern.
That's true.
Yeah. I mean, like, if there's going to be one creature you would play, I think it should be Tracker.
Yeah.
Like, this deck will hit every land drop.
And it has the mana to use all the clue tokens you'll get.
Yeah, I can see Tracker, like, instead of Life from the Loam.
No, instead of Tarmogoyf.
Instead of Tarmogoyf.
Okay.
I mean, to some extent, this deck actually, the more I think about it, really does look like modern version of Legacy Lands. Legacy Lands tries to do the Dark Depths Thesmia Sage combo. Yori tries to use the Awakening Vidugazi Inkmoth Nexus combo. They do the same thing. They're this sort of instant speed thing that lets you do a one-hit KO. I don't think they're equally effective, but the Dark Depths combo is actually just like way too good for modern, and hence the ban. They have Crop Rotation, you have Realms Uncharted, they have Life from the Loam, you have Life from the Loam.
Yeah, I'm halfway to my first Legacy top 8 with this list.
Yes. They have Exploration, you have Arboreal Grazer. Or sorry, maybe that's the Mox Diamond. They have Exploration, you have Sakura Tribe Scout. So yeah, actually, in that sense, like, I feel like the numbers you have really do map pretty well to that deck. And that is a strong deck. It's just that the cards you're using are just like a lot worse. And I feel like modern decks are not actually, in general, a lot worse than Legacy decks. But that said, I mean, I also feel like modern decks are usually not prepared to fight on this axis because it isn't really like a common axis. Although they are prepared to fight on the graveyard axis. I don't know. I mean, I'm definitely really curious to see how it plays out.
Me too, but
Things will get interesting.
Is Realms Uncharted, like, worth playing? I guess that's a question I have.
Yeah, actually, I agree with that. I mean, the whole point of Life from the Loam is that you just sort of slowly dredge over your lands. I mean, maybe you don't have Crop Rotation in this deck, which Legacy Lands relies on to find some of the key lands. On the other hand, like, the key one of Legacy Lands are, like, super different than the one of lands here. I mean, they play cards like Tabernacle of Petrol Veil, which is, first off, extremely expensive dollar-wise. And also a really rare effect that nothing in Modern does anything like that, same with Glacial Chasm. Here, like, I don't know, like, why do you need Blinkmoth Nexus and Inkmoth Nexus? Like, could you just run four Inkmoth Nexus and, like, not go for the Realms Uncharted plan?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of my sense. And, you know, if you need to fetch for something, yeah, eventually Life from Loam would find it. It seems like with so many lands, we could easily splash, I hate to say it, like, Knight of the Reliquary at three instead if we wanted to, like, fetch up something at end of turn.
I put some Elvish Reclaimer in here for that purpose. I'm not sure if I totally believe in that card, but it can do that role. So, yeah, you guys are justifiably skeptical of this card, Realms Uncharted, that has never seen any success.
I mean, it is a 3-mana instant draw, too, so that's something.
I was thinking that even with 27 land, I was thinking about the card Secure Tribe Scout and how only Amulet can use it, and that Amulet is a 28-land deck with bounce lands. And this is a 27-land deck with cycling lands, so it's actually not that high of a land count. So if I'm going to be playing all these exploration effects, I want to, like, have lands. Life from the Loam is good. Ren and Six is good. I just want to test Realms Uncharted and see if it can also fill that role.
I mean, I think, honestly, when you cast it, your opponents won't know what to give you or not give you, so that's you get a brain challenge benefit there.
Which thicket do they give me? The Firelit thicket? The Sheltered thicket?
I know. You need a fourth thicket. The thicket challenge. I do feel, though, that with four Ren and Six and three Life from the Loam, and honestly, why not four Life from the Loam? Don't you have enough ways to get a lot of lands in hand for your scouts? Like, I really don't think Realms Uncharted is where you want to be. I don't think it really compares to Crop Rotation favorably.
Okay. That's something I'll keep an eye out for. All right, let's leave this list as a question mark that we'll have to learn about. So the one list that we had mentioned that none of us actually proposed, but that I think some people on the internet are intrigued by, is something that is called Twiddle Storm. I just want to ask you guys quickly, like, do you think that there is anything there? So I guess the idea is that there are a bunch of you can play a bunch of copies of the card Twiddle, essentially. One mana, instant, untap a permanent.
I mean, what do you mean you can play a bunch of copies? Are there, like, functional reprints of Twiddle?
There's 8 copies that you can play that are clean Twiddles. There's Dreams Grip, which is actually a Twiddle with upside.
Oh my god, a Twiddle with upside?
Then, you know, if you want to go up to 2 mana, there's Hidden Strings, can untap 2 permanents. Psychic Puppetry can do it while splicing onto something like a Peer Through Depths. You can also do it with Toils in Light and Day. You can splice Psychic Puppetry onto that. So these are things that, you know, they untap either 1 or 2 permanents. The idea being that if you have a permanent that generates multiple mana, previously that had to be something like a land with Utopia Sprawl on it or something like that, then each of them becomes a big mana boost, a Seething Song, essentially. There hasn't really been an effort to play those with like the Ravnica bounce lands before, because that's just not really good enough. But Lotus Field seems tailor-made for this. It even has hexproof. It's not vulnerable to Field of Ruin. So you could play this and get the same... I guess I'm trying to think through like what would be the attraction of this deck. What would make it worth even attempting compared to like regular Storm?
Well, we'll start off with like the basic fact, and that's that Dark Ritual is like too good for Modern. The card is extremely strong. It's stronger than the Seeding Song. That card is too good for Modern. And so ideally, like once you get that going, you just sort of assemble some sort of thing involving probably Past in Flames and Grape Shot, and the win is just hopefully easy from there. Even easier because actually your Lotus Veil is better than a Dark Ritual because it taps for different colors. The risk for this list that I don't know is how you get Lotus Veil into play reliably. I mean, like I guess like Expedition Map is maybe the best way to do it. Elvish Reclaimer is like an interesting way to do it. I don't see how you can also even do it reliably before turn 3. It comes into play tapped, which means that you're going to be able to have like a turn 4 Goldfish at the earliest, which is concerning.
You can do it on turn 3 because you don't have to sacrifice untapped lands. You can sacrifice tapped lands.
Oh, okay.
So good, you float point, 2 point. Blue, play your Lotus Field, and then you already have 2 blue to start twiddling. You can kill them on the same turn you play the Lotus Field.
How are you going up cards in this list? Are they playing like Ideas Unbound or something?
That is one that I have seen.
Gifts Ungiven? I mean, I'm trying to think to like each twiddle, okay, it makes a bunch of mana, but I guess you can play Manamorphose too, right? Like,
if you like Google this, you'll find some sort of speculative, like fun, let's test this concept decks. None of them were like competitive finishes. But I think the ratio of cards, you have the template of the current Gift Storm decks where they do play, you know, Desperate Ritual, Heretic Ritual. These are card down, right? They play them anyway because that's essential. You know, you have 8 of those, your Manamorphose, Baral, Chief of Compliance, and Goblin Electromancer. If you just think of those as extra rituals, like that's a lot of the deck that is just rituals. And then like to get the cards back, yeah, it does require Pass and Flames, and then post-board it goes to the pieces of the puzzle plan to get the card advantage. So there's a template for doing this that has worked in Modern, if you just follow the same sort of ratios of cards.
That's kind of interesting. I'm not much of a Storm player, so I guess I can't speak intelligently about if this has advantages over normal Storm. I like the idea of actually giving this hexproof land 9 plus 1 counters now that we're crossing the streams. It can't be targeted. I mean, it just that seems amazing.
Now you're coming around. So, yeah, in answer to your question, Damon, of how do you find the Lotus Field, because this becomes like the key card to find. So existing Gift Storm, they just play a bunch of cantrips, and you know they're hoping to eventually find Baral and or Electromancer. This Twiddles list would not need to find those cards. Instead, you'd have to play like the Expedition Map. Teleria West could find it, or even like Ancient Stirrings. Well, it's not like out of the question. I think Teleria West is probably where I would start.
I mean, I kind of like Expedition Map because it's a 1 plus 2 play versus a 3 play. And it's not clear that you're going to have any other good Teleria West targets.
Teleria West also seems very slow, so you couldn't even do it until turn 4 is when you try to go off.
True. That's a fair point.
I mean, I assume your list is only going to play like 19-ish lands, so... I mean, I guess you could do it all with it on the stack, right? All these Twiddle effects instants.
Hidden Strings.
Hidden Strings is a sorcery, right? But Dream's Grip, I've never heard of that card. Is that an instant?
It is.
Yeah. Okay. I got to read up on some of these. The Splice on Arcane spell, that's an instant too. So yeah, you could do it all with just one land in play, right? Like you float a blue, you play it with a destroy trigger on the stack, you just try to go off. I guess once you cast Past in Flames, you lose a land, but hopefully by then you've made so much mana, you just sort of spend it all.
That is a problem. I guess Past in Flames and Ideas Unbound are both sorceries.
I mean, having to find a one of a 4X in your deck, and as opposed to just being able to like generically go for it with, I mean, Storm can kill you without a mana reducer. That's one big thing, right? I mean,
yeah, this deck is doing nothing. It's twiddling. It's without the Lotus Field in play. So that will be the hurdle to overcome. And I'm not sure whether I'll put one of these together or not, but it's something that to have on our radar, maybe peripheral vision, maybe keep an eye on it. Anyone out there listening wants to take a crack at it? I'm interested to hear more.
I mean, I am legitimately kind of intrigued by giving 9+1+1 counters to this hexproof thing at end of turn, and then just like berserking it when we attack and doing 18 damage to somebody.
I didn't know that. I mean, I sent you a long description of Awakening of Itugazi, like, oh, we could do an episode on this. And you didn't seem interested, so I just tried to shoehorn it in here.
Well,
we can, definitely
there,
do
there
a full...
There wasn't a hexproof land. There's not been a land that just has hexproof, right? I mean...
But there was Tomic Distinguished Advocates. your friendly neighborhood advocates. Okay, fair enough.
I mean, like, how good is a 9/9 hexproof creature in Modern? Like, is even that good?
Well, that's why we double strike it and trample. The one in the red,
Yeah, Temur Battle Rage.
There you go.
I'm not sure about this. Like, the Inkmoth Nexus, like, that's at least a clean kill.
That would also be in the deck, I'm sure.
Yeah, we got angles.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like, if you try both of them, I feel like you'll just go for one of them 80% of the time, and you'll learn that that's the one you should be building around.
Or... you play one of each and Realms Uncharted for it and make them decide which one they want to pick.
Then they put both of them in the graveyard and you're like, well, hell, that'll be the end of that.
Choose your death.
On that note, any final thoughts about Lotus Field before we sign off for the week?
I think I've said all I have to say about Lotus Field.
We have covered a lot of ground. I'm just excited to try it out.
Yeah, me too. I'm sure we'll have a lot of interesting findings to report. Possibly with decks that resemble nothing like what we just described. But that's the process, right? We brainstorm, we brew, and then we iterate. And, you know, we'll get somewhere. So we'll be back next week with more to follow up on these builds and some new brews. So stick around. We'll see you then.
Peace.
That'll do it for episode 10 of the Faithless Brewing Podcast. All of the lists that we discussed on today's show are posted in the show notes. That is to say, they are in the episode description of your preferred podcast player and on the Modern subreddit at r/modernmagic. If you like what you heard today, please consider supporting the show. You can leave us a review on iTunes. That would really make a big difference. We'd really appreciate that. Tell a friend, help us spread the word, and let us know what we can do to improve. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.